Here we are, ready to go on. Aren't we, Tony?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay, I guess I'm ready too. We'll begin. Now, you really wanted to talk about healthcare. I do too, but I'm not as knowledgeable, and I've been out camping and haven't been keeping up on the latest, and it's quite a quagmire. I'm a real advocate of single payer, and I am extremely overall disappointed in this hodgepodge manner in which the reform has been put together. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about that. And you had spoken to me a bit about the myth that two-payer system works. And you're from England, so you can talk a little bit about your experiences there, although you've lived here for many years. Your family is still over there. And
yeah, my mother's 98 years old, and she lives in England, and she's part of the national health system in England, and she's been supported, you know, very well by that program. But to your point about two-payer systems, a lot of comments have been made about, you know, how we don't want to change the system we already have. You know, we have people with private insurance, the Blue Cross, Blue Shields of this world, United Healthcare, and we have people on Medicare, state-run programs. And there's a belief that that's a good and equitable system. But it's been my observation that there's clearly two standards of care.
Absolutely.
And it's directly attributed to the reimbursement levels. No matter how ethical and considerate the healthcare system is, I just cannot conceive that somebody is going to get exactly the same care from the medical system if they are reimbursed at Medicare rates, which are heavily discounted, mm-hmm. to compared with Blue Cross Blue Shield kind of rates.
This whole concept of rates is maybe taxed.
The whole concept of the private insurance system is clearly broken. I mean, I have a personal experience. My wife went to hospital not that long ago for a series of tests, and she saw the bill. It was $9,000 for a day of tests.
That's all too common.
Well, we have a high-end Blue Cross Anthem healthcare insurance plan, and they negotiated the $9,000 down to $3,000. So my first question is, why would you start with 9,000 and then negotiate down to 3,000? Something's a little odd here. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't just kind of fit right. And we ended up getting a bill, and we paid $180 because that was our copay for that particular series of tests. So we didn't cost us very much, but we have a very expensive plan that covered that.
You do.
I haven't found anybody that can provide a rationalization how the insurance, you know, how the hospital can come up with $9,000 and then agree to pay $3,000. Does that mean that somebody doesn't have insurance?
It's called their bargaining power.
Does that mean that somebody doesn't have insurance, gets a $9,000 bill, and their insurance company isn't there to negotiate it down? They get stuck with $9,000. It's outrageous.
It is outrageous, and that is often the case. From what I've heard, they get socked with outrageous bills, and then they end up often claiming bankruptcy. Medical bankruptcy is the common term.
I can share a story about that phenomena. A very good friend of mine, a lady that used to work for me when I was in the high-tech world, moved to England specifically to get on the national health system there to have some back surgery because she knew that because she had pre-existing conditions, she wasn't covered by insurance here in the United States. So she knew what it would cost her. It would cost her essentially her entire savings and probably her house, you know, her real estate investment. So she went to England and in 6 months had established residency and got the surgery done basically for nothing. She thought it was a much better way to handle things, and she decided to stay there. And she's been there 5 or 6 years now.
Was she a British citizen?
No, she was an American citizen.
So you can be an American citizen.
She established residency by living there for 6 months. And
that's
she now works there and made her life there.
Well, that's always an option.
Yeah, we're all going to go to England, yeah.
Well, then you're going to Costa Rica and
well, that's
Thailand,
the other thing.
Dental plans, but also
I heard a program on the radio not that long ago. The host of one of the popular morning shows here in Santa Cruz County from the radio, she had taken an extended weekend off from work and had gone to southern Mexico to an American dentist that had relocated there. and she had extensive dental work done for about 25% of the cost that it would have been to have the same work performed by an American dentist here in Santa Cruz. And the guy's explanation was his overhead's a lot less operating in Mexico. He doesn't have all the liability insurance issues that he had to have in Santa Cruz, and he wasn't tied to the system and the rates. He was able to set his own rates, a fair rate for a fair job.
But offered the same quality of service.
Now, I wouldn't advise or recommend people to go to Uganda or somewhere, you know, for their dental work, because they probably hit them out with hammers there. But you know, this was an American citizen, actually, you know, so it was an American doctor. It was exactly the same. The guy moved all his equipment down south, so it's the same gear that he would have used had he been in Santa Cruz for a quarter of the cost. And so, you know, what's going on with our system here? There's something incredibly broken. And I think that's what the current government's trying to address with their healthcare reform. I share your view as well that I don't think that what they've come up with is an ideal scenario. But it is progress.
I still think, though, we'll be paying an awful lot for it. And the health insurance firms are just going to be passing their increased costs on to the consumer.
We'll see what
no one knows what it is, from what I understand there. How many? 3,000 pages or more?
Yeah, 3,000 page bill that I'm sure none of the people that voted on it read the entire thing. And I even heard that one of the problems they're working on through the reconciliation promise is to remove some student grant language that got its way into the healthcare reform.
How did that get in?
You're definitely asking the wrong person about that. But, you know, sure, it's going to cost. Everything costs money.
You know,
you're not going to get anything for nothing that's worth anything.
But our taxes ought to pay for it. I mean, isn't that?
It's the way other countries, you know, address the problem, is that they have higher levels of taxes. You know, I mean, we have an aversion to paying taxes here in the United States.
But we do. We do pay heavily, and it's obviously not going into healthcare or a lot of social services.
It's going somewhere, but it's certainly...
Could be the war.
Well, we just printed a whole load of money and gave to the banks. And that doesn't seem to have done a whole lot of good.
Now
they want to give it back because they're making record
profits. Oh, they're doing really well, and they're about to claim that they're going to crash soon,
All these incentives to, you know, to help people that were in trouble with their mortgages, and some real low percentages actually got through to the people that needed the help. And it's all stuck.
I should do a study on that.
I think, you know, it's another one of these outrageous situations that's going on at the moment. But if we stick back to the healthcare aspects of it, the idea of reform, I think, is very valid. You know, a lot needs to be done. But, you know, we think two-payer system works. I'm not convinced it does. I think there's going to be an elitist group that have the premium healthcare coverage, and there's going to be government-supported Medicare. And as long as you have a two-payer system like that, there's going to be inequities between the two. Any physician you ask will complain about the low return on Medicare clients. There are physicians that limit the number of Medicare patients that they will handle because of the profitability aspect compared to the Blue Cross of the world.
The reimbursement rates in our county are so low that some physicians have actually left, too. And I'm also concerned about rural areas.
Have you ever met a poor physician? Yeah, my sympathy.
Some that don't have as much as they used to.
Yeah, my heart goes out to them.
Psychiatrists make a fortune. That I know.
Well, that's because we've got a lot of neurotic doctors in Santa Cruz.
I know it. They do. But excuse me, I'm still getting over this laryngitis. I was thinking about the rural areas and how poorly they're served, and I wonder if this bill is making any compensations for, we sort of live in a rural area, but I have family in Florida, very rural area, and I am not sure if they're going to be covered much more. Is it going to be addressing all these gaping holes, too? Well, this will be an interesting exploration the next 4 years.
Well, there's a lot still to be revealed. I mean, you know, I don't know anybody that's read all 3,000 pages of this bill, and bits are being, you know, fed out to us, you know, bits and pieces. So I think as the weeks go by, we'll get to know more about it. But I haven't heard anything specifically referring to the compensation for rural areas versus, you know, city, inner city, you know, levels or more suburban areas. But there is talk of requiring hospitals and physicians to have reduced rates for Medicare-type services. So, and that would tend to go in the opposite direction.
It would.
But it would actually make the gulf between a two-payer system worse. You
know,
you pay less for the Medicare side, and then you have the higher rates for the Blue Cross Blue Shield kind of people, you're going to get, you know, even more dichotomy between the quality of care. That's why I think that the only ultimate solution is a one-payer system. So that it's fair, you get uniform treatment for all.
And there are, people do have a fear of bureaucrats, so that's the soundbite that's going out without the awareness that we're working with bureaucrats now. They're just working for health insurance firms.
Well, precisely, Cindy. The one of the big talking points for the opponents of the reform is, do you want a government bureaucrat making healthcare decisions for you, deciding whether you can have surgery or not for a condition? Mm-hmm. I don't see a huge difference between that and what we have now. Today, a physician has to clear a procedure through my insurance company. Mm-hmm. They contact Blue Cross. They're not talking to a physician at Blue Cross. They're talking to a bureaucrat, you know.
Or a clerk.
A clerk, an
who
administrator.
Who knows nothing about your condition.
Whose role?
He's just told to increase the profits.
And reduce the expenditures, keep the cost down. So, you know, today, if you want a procedure and your insurance company, you know, refuses, then you make a fuss and you continue to escalate and you fight for that, you know. So today you don't have this, you know, magical system where your doctor decides you want surgery and automatically it happens. It has to be cleared by a bureaucrat. So going to a government-run bureaucrat versus a Blue Cross bureaucrat, I don't see a huge difference. I hear a lot of people saying, well, the government's never run anything efficiently. Deal with Blue Cross. I keep knocking them, but deal with any of these insurance companies. Spend 3 hours on the telephone talking to them because you've seen a bill that doesn't make sense and you want to get something sorted out. So they are conveniently difficult to deal with.
After very high insurance rates and premiums.
I read a great article not long ago.
Copays as well.
Oh, yeah. I read a great article a little while ago talking to this point of, you know, how bad is the government at running things. And the example given was the Postal Service. Now,
they do quite a...
The Postal Service delivers hundreds of millions of letters every day, pretty much to the right place. Rarely do you get somebody else's mail. You know, your stuff arrives a day or two after you send it. You know, surprisingly, the next day sometimes here
and
in Santa Cruz.
Private as well, I believe.
I don't think so. I think the USPS is really, it's controlled by the government. Their rates are set by the government. You know, I believe it's a branch of the administration. But the interesting perception about the Postal Service is that letters get delivered. But if you go to the post office and get online with 50 other people and it takes forever because they only have 3 clerks there, you then develop a really negative opinion of the service that you get from the post office because you see one aspect of it. Now, I'm not advocating that the Postal Service has wonderful customer service. It could be improved considerably.
Sure,
but on the other side of it is they deliver a huge number of letters. So is it really run that badly?
It isn't. And it is automated to a large extent, too. If you go in, you just want to buy stamps, you can go over and put your money in a little vending machine.
Yeah. So, you know, the concept that the government doesn't do anything right is also a myth. And again, it depends on which side of an argument you want to get on, is that you can usually clip, you know, a concept.
The argument is often clouded by issues that have nothing to do with the relevancy of what's at hand. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been happening. And also the violence now against some of the Democratic representatives that voted for it. I'm not sure where it's happening. I just heard something this morning on the radio in Kansas. I don't remember the representative's name, but he was given death threats and there was some destruction to his property. And
it's 300 million people in this country.
Scary.
You know, I'm sure we've got our share of fruits and nuts.
But I've never heard it to this extent, just over the healthcare reform, and it's not much of a reform. The insurance companies are making out like bandits.
Well,
they have no idea what are they so angry about. There's just a lot of ignorance in terms of what.
Well, do people have a perception that, you know, their health care, if they have, you know, existing coverage
perception.
Through, you know, they, if they have existing coverage through an insurance program, probably paid for by their employers, part of their compensation package, mm-hmm. That it's going to be taken away from them or degraded in some way. And there's no clear evidence of that. There are people in this country that believe there should be no federal government and just run by the states.
That's an idea.
Well,
depending on which state you're in and what's been decided.
Well, we have enough trouble coming to agreement from one federal government. Can you imagine 50 states trying to, you know?
I know that.
I mean,
you're traveling,
all pulling in their own direction. The whole
that
country.
That may be happening, though. States, I suspect, will start looking at this new law carefully and then making improvements, hopefully.
Well, there are going to be some. One of the requirements that I have picked up on is that it addresses the very large number of people that do not have healthcare insurance today. And a lot of those people, particularly at the lower income levels, are going to be supported by an expansion of the current Medicare plan. The current Medicare plan really is designed to help seniors and persons with significant disabilities.
Hmm.
And, you know, one of the provisions of the reform is that lower income people can be brought into that Medicare environment. So there'll be more Medicare business.
Something monthly if they'll
well, if you, be taxed. If you don't have any income, you're not going to be able to pay
maybe
a premium.
Depends on
people are going to have
earn.
To be supported.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the president did wander around saying he was going to provide affordable health care. I haven't seen anything.
That's similar to the public option, then.
Well, but I haven't seen any. Well, yes. I mean, granted, that Medicare is a public option. But I think the people that advocated public option were talking about one flat, one payer system run by a federal
where
you know,
you're
entity.
Not paying insurance companies, these middlemen.
Oh, yeah.
In a manner of speaking.
Several of the things the president talked about being able to buy insurance across state lines, does not appear to be covered in this. He did run around telling everybody that healthcare was going to be affordable for all, and I have people that work for me that can't afford to pay anything for healthcare.
I know.
And it's some of those will be helped with this expansion of the Medicare program, but a significant number of people won't be helped by that. There's this concept, if you don't have insurance, you're going to be fined in some way. If you don't have any money, how are they going to take it?
You know, mandatory insurance.
We're going to give an arm and a leg, you know, take my fifth child.
I know.
I mean,
it.
It's not going to happen.
No.
You know, we live in a civilized society, but, you know, I don't believe that, you know, the healthcare insurance companies can continue to, you know, to take advantage of the system the way they clearly do.
Now, how is it funded in England? Is it
the healthcare
tax
system
that goes strictly for healthcare, or is it apportioned to other social services? Do you know?
I think it's a general. It comes out of a general fund. I mean, you don't get a if you're employed in England and you get a paycheck and it shows how much taxes are taken out. Given to the government, it doesn't break it down and say, oh, $10 goes to Medicare and $5 goes to transportation and $6 goes to education. It doesn't break it down like that. It goes into a general fund.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, part of the role of government is to balance the amount of monies that come in from, you know, the tax base mm-hmm. with the expenditures. And, you know, when times are good, lots of people are working, more money comes in, more money is available to go out. When lots of people get unemployed and companies, you know, start moving the jobs offshore, so the country not only has unemployed people but has less work being done mm-hmm. in this country, you end up with a smaller tax base. And so that's one of the reasons why, particularly here in California, that we've gone into this unbalanced budget. We were providing services and benefits for the population of California based on income levels that were overinflated in the late 90s because of the dot-com boom and all the other good stuff that was going on.
But a lot of homeowners paid very little in terms of property insurance.
Well, that goes back, what, 30 years to Proposition whatever, 19, whatever it was, that fixed income tax, property taxes. Was it in the Reagan era, I guess?
I believe
so. I think
so.
It was just before I came to, I came to California in 84, and it was already in
just
place.
Just before it was.
I think probably in 81, 82, something like that. So it was a very creative thing to do at the time, and it capped this runaway cost of property taxes. But
for
on the
some.
Other hand, it took an awful lot of money out of the education system. Mm-hmm. And the California education system took a step back for many years because it was underfunded. It got built back up again in the late 90s
and
with
now
the
it's
boom
tumbling
times.
Down again.
And now it's down again, yeah. I mean, a friend of mine was telling me just the other day, somebody in the school district, all the teachers have got pink slips, you know. They don't know whether they're going to get jobs or not next year. Most of them will be retained, but not all. And you don't know which ones. You don't know whether you're going to have a job or not next
but
year.
But many are rehired or have been in the past.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, what a process that we go through. We fire everybody
it.
So we can hire them back
I
again.
Know.
Or who
I know.
We
doesn't
want to hire back.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's not very nice, I don't
no,
think.
It
I'm
isn't.
Glad I'm not in that world.
It doesn't make any sense. And we talked a little bit on the phone about the death panels under nationalized healthcare system.
Well,
what
again,
a fear-based lie.
The famous former governor of our most northern state, you know,
Payton.
Made a big deal about death panels and how terrible a nationalized healthcare system was, or a government-run system. There is absolutely no evidence that there are any official rules for cutting off care when a person reaches a certain age in the British National Health System. I go back to my stories of my mother, 98 mm-hmm. years old. She lives in a cross between assisted living and a skilled nursing home. So we don't, it's a slightly different model than we have here, but she lives in, she's been about 18 months in this place. Up until then, she lived totally independently. But now she lives in this nursing home. In the last year, she's had brand new hearing aids, $7,000, a typical price for, you know, I believe, for high-end hearing aids, and it didn't cost her a penny. Came out of, you know...
The general fund.
I'll come back to that in a moment. She's 98 years old, and she has a lump in her breast, and the doctors are talking to her about, does she want to have surgery or not?
Wonderful.
Right? So, I mean... You wouldn't be operating on a 98-year-old. I mean, I would advise her not to do it. I don't think she's going to do it. It doesn't make any sense at her age.
But clearly giving her the option.
But she has an option. She has a choice, right? So clearly there's examples that there is absolutely no truth in this concept that there are death panels in the British National Health System. Any more than there are here in the United States, where insurance companies have to give the okay whether or not a person gets recovered
surgery. Doesn't matter what
age
you are. It's just a matter of price. Are you expendable? Well, this is a bit expensive. Of course you are.
In my home care business, I've met families and I've talked to families who have elderly parents that have a condition that could require some level of operation. Mm-hmm. And there are physicians in Santa Cruz County that refuse to operate on people because of the risk of something going wrong and passing, you know, dying during an operation, mm-hmm. and that their liability insurance will get hammered for it, and so they decline to provide that care. I have a true story of somebody who the doctors at Dominican refused to operate because they said that she was too old and she couldn't survive the surgery and it was too big a risk on their liability insurance. This family were Shakers and Movers and associated with the university. Went down to Watsonville Community Hospital, found a doctor down there that operated successfully. This was to repair a fractured hip.
Oh, and that's
had this
common.
Lady not had her hip fixed, they were going to send her home with a few Tylenol and a few painkillers. She probably would have been dead within a couple of weeks because,
constantly.
You know, of the pain, you know, and the distress that it would have caused her. She had surgery. They fixed her hip. You know, 3 months later, the last I heard, she was doing fine.
So a lot of the additional expense, it seems to be coming from fear.
Well, a lot of the concerns
risks.
About the healthcare reform is fear-driven. A lot of the objections is fear-mongering. It's not based on fact.
And the expense of the liability insurance, so much is passed on.
Well, I mean, that's what I mean. The other issue that people sometimes don't recognize is that as an individual, privately insured person myself, mm-hmm. I'm paying a significant premium inside my monthly premium for the uninsured in the county that get taken care of at Dominican Hospital.
Yeah.
Now, they have no choice. They have to go there to get help. They can't afford health care insurance, so they go to the emergency room and they're treated. Now, Dominican Hospital has to stay in business.
I'm not
so
sure
they
if they're
have
always
to.
Treated, though. I had a dear friend. Well, I guess he waited too long. He had a growth in his arm and never sought treatment because he didn't have any insurance and was afraid to. And I think it could have been treated. It could have been removed, but they told him it was too late. So he had to go into assisted living in terrible conditions. It was deplorable. And he passed away shortly after that due to the growth.
Yeah.
Well, I really don't know what the situation was.
Well, there's two aspects to that. One is, you know, somebody that doesn't have insurance, that doesn't go and take care of it, that it could make it worse.
Could have gone sooner. I really
and that may have, you know, without understanding the true medical situation. But the other aspect of that is that people are going with emergencies. See, the key is they treat emergencies at the emergency room.
But he was an emergency.
Well, I mean, if they collapsed in the street and was taken to the hospital, he didn't have insurance, they would have treated him. But the treatment would have been to have made him comfortable or, you know, I mean, I'm not a doctor,
minimal.
So you
know.
I'm not prescribing
with insurance,
a solution
there. That two-tier system, those with insurance probably would have been given the surgery and the necessary.
But people are not turned away. You know, people cut their arm, you know, in an accident, you know,
seemed
work,
like
you know, and don't have insurance. They turn up at the emergency room, they'll clean the wound, they'll stitch it, you know, they'll send, you know, give them some.
I see what you're saying, the basic.
Yeah. I mean, I know people that turn up at the emergency room when their kids have got colds because they can't afford to take them somewhere to get
it's
a doctor
absurd.
To prescribe something. But, I mean,
we need clinics where you don't necessarily have doctors, but nurses or even trained practitioners in the basics of healthcare that can dispense.
Yeah. But again, from a social conscious standpoint, how degrading must that be to somebody to have to go to the emergency room and make out it's an emergency so they can get some treatment because they can't afford to look after their children?
I know the humility. Yeah.
We're the richest country, supposed to be the richest country in the world, the best country in the world to live in, and
it's
we treat a huge percentage of our population, you know, as second class citizens. It's outrageous.
It is. It is outrageous, and I'm seeing it in so many other areas too. But in England, so the insurance is paid for out of a general fund.
The National Health Insurance is funded, yes, it's generally, and it's administered by, you know, counties, you know, the equivalent of federal monies being managed by states and counties and cities,
mm-hmm.
as federal money gets dispersed
down.
Here.
So it's less
they have similar system. Well, it's such a geographically diverse place. There's only 50 million people, not 300 million, but it's much more compact. So we don't have states in England. They have counties that perform the similar role. They're the next mm-hmm. level under the central government. Whereas here we've got states and then counties because of the smaller, compact nature of the country. They're just states. Counties. But you might have, if they're rural counties, you might have two or three counties that are banded together, you know, it's more like a region. Mm-hmm. But the monies get dispersed into these communities, and then it's administered then through hospitals that are funded by the National Health, you know, physicians, mm-hmm. you know, and other services. And in fact, my mother's facility that she lives in is funded by the National Health System, you know, and so there's a residential, you know,
and the
section
quality.
Of it, and the quality seems to be fine. I mean,
wonderful.
I've been to all of the assisted living communities here in Santa Cruz County in the summer. Absolutely wonderful places. There are some that are less than attractive. She lives in a fine place. It's 50 or 60 people in. It's in a converted country home in rural England.
For
it's
all
fields,
the baby
green fields, green fields out of the window. She has her own private room. There's RNs on staff, so she can get help 24/7.
Oh, that's great.
But it's not free. You know, she's not paying anything for it today, but it's not free.
Her taxes
she
did
paid
at
taxes
one point.
Throughout her life when she worked.
But she didn't, in addition to that,
she put money,
pay
she,
money
she
into
didn't put any additional money in because the tax basis
firm.
Is higher. You know.
Yeah.
I'm paying more for my health insurance than I'm paying in taxes.
A lot more.
Right?
You are.
So I, on one hand, I'm going to say, hey, I feel good about this. I love living in America because my tax rate is low, but my outgoings are ridiculously high because I have to pay this outrageous
just
amount for my health insurance.
I know it. And then you think of we have very little subsidized housing.
Like taking one pocket, money
from
one
education.
Pocket, taking money from one pocket, putting it in the other.
I know.
We're kidding ourselves.
And I'm curious, is housing subsidized as well on education?
Education is heavily subsidized, even through universities.
Much more humane.
Well, it's a number of years ago since I was at university, but my university education was free. I had free academics, and I had a grant, you know, to pay for the board and lodging and books.
Oh, my. Was that typical?
Yes. No, I went to
university. So you're not bankrupt when you're graduating.
Well, yeah. But when you start...
How civil.
When you graduate, you get into the workplace and you start paying taxes. And you pay taxes throughout your life. You just pay taxes at a higher rate. But taxing is it isn't the dirty word that it is. It's a five-letter word, taxes.
It sounds like as an overall philosophy, then there's more altruism. There is an expectation that we care for one another.
Well, yes.
And no one is left.
That's right. And if you happen to be fortunate enough to be wealthy... you know, wealthier than the average through the system, then you have the opportunity to get premium care if you
sure.
so desire. So it doesn't restrict people from growing up through the social,
but
you
no
know,
one
success
is denied
ladder.
An education or health care.
The lower levels, nobody's left behind. The famous phrase about education, it's true in it's true in the British system of national health that nobody's left behind. Everybody is taken care of. If you visit England as an American citizen on vacation, you break your arm, you go to the hospital, they'll treat you. You say, hey, I'm an American citizen, I don't... They just take care of you.
That was true in England and Canada as well.
Yeah. Fortunately, I've not been in ill health when I've been to Canada.
Neither was I, but I had some friends
that
were.
I've had a few headaches there, but that's another story. But the interesting thing about taxes, people... I used to it. I lived with it in my life while I lived in England. I must admit, I did like coming to the United States and paying lower taxes. I felt really good about that. But I've since come to realize that, you know, I'm paying for these things in other ways. It isn't quite as attractive as I thought it was.
Education is outrageous.
Well, the one thing that really amuses me is in England, we have value-added tax. Now, value-added tax, the tax is added into the price of the item. So you go into store to buy a $100 computer, it's accessory, you pay $100. The tax is in there.
You have 17%, no idea.
I believe it's 17% now, value-added tax, might be higher. But it's built into the price. So you get there and you pay $100, you get your $100 item. Here, you buy a $100 item and you have to pay $109.25 for it.
I know, you hear the...
right? I mean...
You get the information after the fact, after purchase.
Yeah, so but does that make us feel better that we're only paying $100? Oh, shall we say, let me...
It's
if you end up with a total cost of $100 for an item, does it make you feel better that it's listed for $91 and then you pay $100?
Lord, no. I actually feel worse. I feel like I've been cheated constantly. And it's in our minds more, the awareness that we're paying taxes.
Makes it such a bad
like
deal. It's built into the price, you get used to it. You know, you just get on with life.
It's almost an encouragement to distrust paying them or to feel the pain of it.
That's right.
More intensely than you do in England.
Yeah, and not that the system's perfect over there. Please don't misunderstand my point. But I'm just hoping that your listeners can appreciate that, you know, there's a lot of fallacy in what's described how system works, you know, in other countries. And it isn't just England. I just happen to speak about England because I lived there for many years. I know about the system. I'm working that system now because of my mother. I'm an only child, so I'm looking after her from 6,000 miles away. But there are similar systems throughout Europe. You know, the system seems to be, I would describe it as fair.
And I believe in Austria, or Switzerland, they're largely... The healthcare system is largely run by insurance companies, but they're heavily regulated.
If
their prices are not terribly, and Germany as well, there's a mixture.
Well, again, this idea of regulation and government control seems to be a big problem for, you know, a large part of the United States. Let me just use the example of what happened in the Bush administration. They deregulated the banking industry and the investment industry because they didn't, you know, their philosophical position was that, you know, these individual companies should have a right to determine how they operate and how they do business and get creative and find new ways to make money to plow back to the shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens after deregulation? These criminals, they're absolute criminals, end up with these incredibly complex and diverse investment schemes that to this day people can't explain
and
understand.
People were encouraged to invest suddenly, and people they too thought they could make a fast fortune.
Yes.
And were encouraged to do so, yes. Savings without the window, and they lost their shirts.
It's a legalized pyramid scheme, I guess.
It is.
I mean, it was just outrageous, and people just dumped money into it. These banks and these investment people made a huge amount of money on the upside, and when it turned tail, it was, oh, sorry, we don't have any money to pay our bills.
Take whatever we can.
Bail us out.
I know.
Help us.
I know. And they were. And that very quickly, and it was all.
And there's an example of deregulation.
Again.
So is it right to say that?
Well, the regulations are sometimes in place, but just not enforced.
Well, that's true. But, I mean,
the bureaucrats were fired.
Well, a lot of people believe in the freedom of the individual and, you know, not wanting big government, you know, to be intrusive in their lives. And there's merit in that basic argument. But on the other hand, you know, totally free hand to run amok, you know, and that's how people, if you go back long enough, that's when we had little boys being shoved up chimneys to clean them.
Yeah.
Right? There were no regulations.
And that's
so
why England
you had
does have
child
such
labor. You have child labor
now.
You know, people taking advantage of that. I mean, it's not that long ago that New York City had the sweatshops in the garment district.
I believe they still do.
Well, I've not been there for a while, but again, they have those in other countries now.
And here too.
And, you know, so some level of regulation is important. You know, we have laws.
Of course.
That's regulation. We can't be trusted. I mean, I think it's ridiculous to say, well, we don't want any laws at all. We'll just govern our own selves, you know. Does that mean we're going back to the Wild West and, you know, we shoot people that come up our street at night because we don't know who they are?
Can feel like that lately.
Well, some people may need shooting, but...
Oh, no, I'm not going to go that far. But,
but
it can.
But, you know, we're in the 21st century. We're in the 21st century now, you know. I mean, I'm not advocating, I don't think it makes any sense at all to go back to child labor and total deregulation, as some people seem to think is a good idea. I mean, not that they're suggesting child labor, but, I mean, that's just a natural extent. I mean, we got out of child labor by having regulations and
exactly,
rules.
Exactly, and many other horrendous situations. But to get back to the system in England, how were pre-existing conditions handled?
As there are no insurance companies, the government, there is a national health system, right? You are ill, you are treated. There is no such thing as a pre-existing condition because there is no paid, there's no qualification for entry. You are born, you are in the system. When my first daughter Nikki was born, she was born in England. The day she was born, she was issued a national health insurance number. So she was automatically in the system. To this day, although she's lived here in the United States for 32 of her 33 years, she could go back to England with her national health number, you know, and be recognized by the system.
Great.
So there is no such thing as a pre-existing condition. But then we listen to our president saying there is not going to be any pre-existing conditions. I keep hearing comments.
The insurance company will raise their rates accordingly.
I'm going to be very intrigued to see what happens.
I am too.
Because maybe this is the strategy of the government, that this first initiative of reform takes it, you know, is the first step on a process.
Mm-hmm.
And people there are a lot of people that don't believe we should go ahead with the reform as it is at the moment because they believe in the concept of the private insurance companies. Mm-hmm. But perhaps, you know, if the private insurance companies now react to this initiative by significantly increasing their rates because they now have to cover pre-existing conditions, no lifetime caps, children up to the age mm-hmm. of 25 or 26, whatever it is in the proposal, they're going to increase their rates and yeah. they're going to look and they're going to appear to be what they are, money grabbers. And so I think there'll be then a huge reaction against the insurance companies, and then I think an even further groundswell of support for the idea
and
of a single-payer kind of system.
I just hope it isn't brushed under the rug. People feel we now have reform. It will not be talked about much, and the new policies will go into effect. And until there is a huge upswelling.
Oh, I don't think for one moment this is not going to be talked about. I mean, we're going to be bored to death before long on this. But if you go back to, you were away at the weekend, but
I was
within an hour or so of the announcement of the vote to pass it. There was a Republican spokesman said, "Don't worry, in November when we win back control of the Congress, we'll repeal this." So that's within an hour, you know. Now, what it is telling me, of course,
and
is that this
sometimes
is...
Sometimes I wonder if these standards or these positions are taken just for show, because they're obviously going to benefit tremendously because the insurance companies are funding their campaigns as well.
Well, but the other side of that, you know, I think we also have to recognize that... 2 days after that initial outburst, which I think brought some ridicule on that position because, you know, how childish is that?
Well, we're used to that.
The Republican Party is now saying that they're going to reform the reform. So they're going to modify what has been done rather than and improve. I think they've got the word improve.
Well,
so they're modifying and improve the plan rather than say we're going to take it away.
I'll have to watch Fox News if I can stand it and see what they're coming up with.
Oh, your colors
point.
Are showing.
You know, they always do. I. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, and excuse me, what I love about it is we can say what we want. That is why.
Well, I was a lifelong capitalist up until about 5 or 6 years ago when I got involved in this healthcare business. Done a complete 180 in that sense. I'm not a Democrat. You know, I'm apolitical in that sense. In fact, I don't see much good in either of them.
I think we're probably both at different ends of the spectrum, and we're coming together and meeting in the middle.
Well, or we're going so far around the outside that we're going around the back of everything
yes.
and lost sight of reality while they're around the back of the planet.
What happened?
I'm inclined to think that we need some alternative approach because, you know, how divisive has this reform become, you know?
On one hand of the aisle,
well, you mentioned the insurance companies. I'd love to know the true numbers involved, but I'm led to believe that significant investment was made by the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry.
Pharmaceutical, definitely.
Don't leave them out of this. Put money on both sides of the aisle. I mean, they put money in Republicans, they put money in Democrats, and that's one of the reasons why this whole program had been blocked and slowed down. It took them a year to get to this point. Mm-hmm. I just think they put so much money in the campaigns of people. I just find that, you know, if we want to reform something, we should reform campaign funding. I mean, was the story about the guy that was re-elected as the mayor of New York spent $100 million of his own money.
We have Meg Whitman also working hard to purchase the governorship of California on Schwarzenegger's heels.
Well, you know, I my understanding of civics, you know, was government for the people by the people, not government for the people by the rich elected.
The corporations, I think, have absconded with it. It's gotten out of control.
Wow.
We're bordering on fascism. You can say it openly.
If you go back to the sort of 30s, right, the problems they had in Europe under a fascist system, you know, I think what they called National Democrats, were they? Was it the National Democratic Party?
All alternative parties.
Well, yeah, they did a lot of incredibly bad things, but
one
of the things they did do was standardize, you know, a lot of the support for the majority of the people that lived there. So for a few years, it looked pretty good. But You know, sadly,
can you say
lost
a
its
bit
way.
More about that? What did they do exactly? They standardized.
Well, I mean, when the Nazi Party came into power in the 30s, the country was, people were taking wheelbarrows full of money to get loaves of bread.
Oh yes, the monetary system.
Yeah, the monetary system was broken. You know, they put in versions of healthcare. You know,
in the name of
it was in a very bad name, efficiency. Yeah, but.
And
yeah,
what that means is ultimate control and dictatorship. I've learned that through the years.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the... I often like to remark about communism. I think communism was a pretty nasty kind of program, particularly
in practice,
if we lived here in the West. But if you actually go back to Russia in 1918, when they came to power... It looked pretty good. If you were a peasant in Russia, life was pretty darn miserable.
I know. I would have been dancing in the
streets. The Tsars and
the
barons and everybody else, you know, kept the population, you know, in total poverty. I mean, it was a very evil system.
Yes.
And so communism came on, and for a while, it really helped a lot of people until itself, you know, became a corrupt concept. I mean, it wasn't a workable concept compared to what we did here in this country. A much better system, worked for much longer. But the system seems to have run its course. You know,
I think
we need to do something different.
We're a declining empire, Tony.
Well, I've been there.
That's why I call it tickling the belly. You have been there.
Well, yeah. When I was a schoolboy, we had an atlas. You know, every schoolboy was handed his atlas, his geography classes.
Yes.
And you had the different countries in the world. And the British Empire was coloured pink. Now, although I was in school in the 50s and 60s, the maps had all this pink over them because it was part of the British Empire.
And you watched it chip away.
And yes, in the last 50 years, that has chipped away considerably. You know, it's no longer what it was. So I observed it started to decline, a shrinking, you know, much earlier than that. And the formation of the Commonwealth with Canada and Australia and New Zealand.
Yes.
But they're still affiliated as the Commonwealth.
They are.
And, you know, this, you go to Canada, the Queen is still on the currency.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, she doesn't have any control. She has no power.
It's a huge empire.
But that was something that was built up from a very small country, you know, several hundred years ago on the back of sea power. Basically. But it was a system that went around the world and took advantage of the countries that it found.
Oh, for sure. Stole their resources.
Ripped everybody out. Ripped everybody off.
Colonialism.
And the money went back to the crown and to the rich people that, you know, controlled the investments and the bankers. You know, and the rich got richer and the poor around the world were taken advantage of.
As well as the poor in England that worked the streets.
So eventually greed and corruption, you know, was the downfall of that system and it started to fall apart.
We learned from Britain. We're close allies.
The United States did not, you know, go around the world conquering countries.
We are now.
One or two.
We'd like to.
It exported corporations.
Exactly.
Right? And American corporations were throughout Europe, throughout the world, and brought success and growth to many countries, you know, raised the standard of living.
All
on our terms, but it did wonderful things. But what I've seen in the last 10 years...
It destroyed some beautiful ways of life as well.
But what's happened in the last 10 years is that many of those corporations have gone south.
Yes,
they're no longer what they used to be. They don't represent the. I mean, IBM used to be held up as the epitome of manufacturing expertise, manufacturing muscle. They, like many other companies,
they
have
were
exported
dismantled.
Their manufacturing offshore.
Absolutely.
Major.
And they were dismantled here, and we're left with an empty factory.
I was in the semiconductor industry, in the electronics sector. We were the people that invented offshore technology. You know, we shipped jobs up. Back in the 70s, we shipped work offshore, and over the years, more and more of that work got shipped offshore. So jobs were exported. You know, they're no longer, you know, available here in the United States. You know, it's a sad thing.
We've become consumers.
So what I think is that the United States capital system has kind of run its course. You know, what have we seen in the last 10 years?
It's no longer.
Greed and corruption in Wall Street and Washington. Mm-hmm. So what we need is something new. I don't know what it's called. I don't know what it's going to look like. But it's going to have some content of social conscience. Because we have to help the people that can't help themselves.
And England resurrected itself in my eyes by incorporating that to their system to an extent. And Canada. Most Western nations have. we're going to have to get our next guest on in a minute.
That'll be fun.
You know what? We didn't stick with medical care, but I thoroughly enjoyed our circular route in our discussion. Let me see what music I have here. I wish I'd gotten the Beatles, because what can you say about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones when you were...
Oh, I was reading an article just the other day of somebody that was lamenting how, you know, they were over the Beatles, and I can't help myself. It's just the nostalgia of that time frame. It has to be similar to people that grew up in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury, you know, late 60s, early 70s era, you know, with the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane and so forth. Growing up in England in the 60s was a version of that. You know, every week a new band came out. Everybody waited for the next Beatles song to be released. It was an exciting, you know, time. We didn't have MTV, and so we used to get our information about music from a weekly music show, a bit like Bandstand used to be here. Used to have a program called the Ready, Steady, Go, and the new acts would launch their records on that program. So you want to be home at 7 o'clock on a Friday evening so you could see Ready, Steady, Go.
There was such an explosion of music and creativity then.
Oh yeah. But, you know, my first recollection of music was American bands and groups like the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly in that era. So, and then of a sudden, you know, that did a 180, and suddenly there were Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers and the Rolling Stones and all that kind of stuff coming along.
I'm going to
and
have
then
to get
switch
something
the other
here
way.
But during the afternoon, I'll let you select what you want to play. But right now, what do I have here? Umama Ya Jabula, I believe. And then we'll be talking with Lou Hamburger, who was held hostage and is going to share with us what he learned. Let me see if I can get this on.
Umamuya jabul, 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 um
Good afternoon. This is Janaea with Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the Heartland of Santa Cruz. Free Radio Santa Cruz is what you're listening to, 101.1 FM. And as you know, we're always looking for donations. And those can be mailed to FRSC P.O. Box 7811-95061. And my next guest is Dr. Lou Hamburger. And he's been a psychotherapist working with trauma, disaster relief, suicide abuse, and depression for many years. And actually in that process found himself being held hostage by terrorists. And I'm going to ask him to share his experience, what he learned from that, and what he took away from that experience and many others that he had in his life. And he recently came out with a book that summarizes what he learned, and it's about sculpting your life, finding the humor, can't find the willpower, everything you should have learned since kindergarten. Let me see if he's with us now. Dr. Hamburg, are you with us?
He's with you.
Oh, great. Let me turn you up a little bit. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Tickling the Belly of the Beast. Hi.
Tickling the Belly of the Beast.
Yes, from the heartland of Santa Cruz. Because I feel personally like we are in the throes of a beast currently. The conditions that we're living.
I would move to Santa Cruz in a heartbeat.
You would? And you're from Tucson?
Yeah, well, now I am, yeah.
Where were you from originally?
I was born in Baltimore, lived in, went to school in Ann Arbor at University of Michigan.
Oh.
Lived in Baltimore until I was about 34 or so, and moved to Philadelphia, then back to Washington, D.C., and spent most of the last 20 to 30 years of my life in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, Canada. Oh, so
yeah.
We were just talking about health care and comparing the British system a bit with our system, and we didn't know much about the Canadian system, but if you had been talking with us then, you could have chimed in because I had questions. That'll be another show.
Works.
It works.
Yes, in a word.
Oh, I would love to go on and ask you about that, but I want to first of all begin by asking you, when you were held hostage, how did that experience basically impact your life, and what happened?
Well,
this happened in D.C.
It happened in D.C., and a group of American Muslims and their leader took the hostages in three separate buildings in Washington. I was in the B'nai B'rith building. They also took City Hall, where they killed a man and shot Marion Barry in the leg. And then they took the Muslim mosque as well. Why, we still don't know. But anyway, I'm not sure what I learned from it. My wife and I learned to loosen the purse strings, I'll tell you that.
Loosen the purse strings?
Yeah, because, you know, you live for the moment, and then the moment turns sour. So, you know, things you thought were important aren't so important when you go through that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what, we learned. But, I don't know.
It must have been terrifying.
Well, you know, you have things to do in the beginning. There's a lot of screaming and yelling and gunshots and machetes being waved, which are much more scary than guns, by the way. But then it all settles down, and you realize that the terrorists are just as much hostage as you are. They aren't going anywhere. So, you know, it settled down, and it was very quiet. And a big problem becomes, how do you get a bunch of people to the bathroom? They had tied us up hand and foot, and when it came my turn, they dragged me out in the middle of the floor. And at one point, one of the guards, there were two guards in the room, and one of them couldn't get my binds untied.
Oh.
So he screamed at the other one, "What idiot tied these?" And the guy said, "I did. He had found my secretary and I in our closet, you know, on our normal Wednesday." But he took exception there, hiding in there. So hit me with the rifle and kicked her across the room, actually. And her husband said she had a foot mark on her butt for about 3 weeks. Anyway, when they came time to untie me, this guy decided it was my time to go. So I heard the weapon. The guy said, I tied it, and I'd kill them. Not nice word. At that point, if Allah would let me. And he picked up his M16, and I heard the safety go off. And thought, nice wife, nice kids, nice life. Just take me out. Don't wound me. And the guy behind me said to him, well, put that thing down. There's plenty of time for killing. So he did. He put it down. I heard the safety go off. And the guy behind me, and then he hollered at me, okay, but when the time for killing comes, he's the first to die. Okay, to get shot. So the guy behind me said, well, you still want to go to the bathroom? I said, no, I think I just did. And he said, okay, get back to the wall. So I go back to the wall where we were sitting, and my best friend of 20 years and a colleague was sitting there next to me. And as I slid down to get back to my place, he looked up at me and said, what are you coming back here for? How do we know how good a shot that guy is? So even in the middle of all of that, he laughed.
Humor. Yeah.
Yeah. The next day, the Hilton had sent over some donuts and coffee for us for breakfast or whatever. I mean, you lose track of time. And but they wouldn't untie the men, so they had the women come across the room and feed us our coffee and donuts. The woman who fed me was a wonderful secretary that I had hired about 3 weeks before. And as she started to let me sip on the coffee, I said to her, hey, Nat, there are some things about the job description I forgot to tell you. At which point, she shoved the donut in my mouth, gagging me, and poured the coffee down my chest. And had a smile that lit up the room. So even in the bad times, you know, you can humor becomes part of your life. Recently, I worked with, a couple years ago, I worked with Katrina victims who were airlifted out here, survivors.
Oh.
And they spent the first 2 hours that they were here in the middle of a desert when they had been in a swamp in the morning and shipped a couple thousand miles, and nobody knew where they were going. And still, in spite of all of that, with only the clothes on their back, they sat there for the first couple hours laughing, telling jokes, being albeit gallows humor, but
yeah,
they found the humor in the mess, and that helped them gain enough perspective to keep some balance in the middle of it all.
Yeah.
But, you know, I learned the power of humor, but I learned that from my mom and dad when I was 4, so.
You know, and sometimes it's a process to practice finding humor.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. That's been my experience, and I've had to foster that. And I know too that when I do, it becomes more automatic and makes life that much more bearable and enjoyable. And
you ever read Viktor Frankl?
Oh, yes.
Man's Search for Meaning.
Sure, one of the first books I read. Beautiful.
Oh, yeah, it's a great book.
Very inspiring.
One of the things he says is that in the concentration camps, they found humor. And what he called it was a person, the ability to find the humorous side of things is some sort of trick learned while mastering the art of living. And he's right.
What a survivor. Survival skill.
Yeah.
But what do you recommend for cultivating a sense of humor?
Well,
in dire situations, because
you've
certainly been in many.
You can't wait until something comes along and tickles your funny bone. The standard, and the thing that helps me with my patients, which I will, you know, research over the years has developed an accepted number of repetitions to master an art or a skill like hitting a baseball or playing a Beethoven sonata. You got any idea what number that might be? It's 10,000.
Oh.
So if you're going to have humor become part of your life, you have to practice it. And you have to look for it, and you have to work at it. It's not going to just naturally come to you. Unless you're lucky like I am and have a name like Hamburger and realize by about age 3 that you either better find some humor in that or you're going to be permanently aggravated.
Yes.
So, my mom used to, I remember when I was under 5, and my mom used to get these calls on Saturday night. We didn't have internet or TV in those days, so kids amused themselves by calling up, looking in the phone book, calling up Hamburgers and ask if you had any with onions or that kind of stuff. And my mom would always say, instead of getting, pardon me, pissed off at them, you know, she'd just engage them in conversation. Oh, you want onions, you want ketchup, you know, and then start talking with them. And so I learned early on that you better find some humor in life because it just made things better.
Yeah.
And then as I got older, when I was in the Army, it was some dark night or morning at Fort Knox, and in the Army you fall out for a 5 o'clock breakfast at 3 o'clock in the morning with a full battle gear and pack and rifle and all that stuff. And we fell out, about 200 people, and this guy, the air sergeant, started reading the roll. When he got to my name, I was in the back, which is always the place to be in the Army. And when he got to my name, he said, "Hamburger, yes, sir. Come here, boy." He called me out in front of 200 guys. It was dark. He looked at me, and I'm only 5'4", and this guy must have been 6-something. He looked down at me, and the rule in the Army is to be invisible. So my knees were shaking. What did I do now? What was going to happen to me? He looked down at me and said, "I have a question for you." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." "Okay. Is your name really Hamburger?" And 200 guys behind me, you could hear them just stifling a laugh, you know. So at that point I realized my sense of humor better swing into action.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to be off balance. So it's helped me a lot.
Your
and
last
I have a lot of fun,
did.
And I irritate my family, of course, and my kids.
But how do you irritate them?
Oh, because, you know, I just tease a lot and kid a lot.
Oh, you're
but
a trickster.
Then, so does my brother, and so do my kids now.
It's a family trait.
Even my grandkids give me a hard time. A couple of weeks ago, well, the last time my grandson was out, I had been carded at the national parks here.
You were?
You know, people ask me my card because I'm a senior citizen. I get a discount.
Oh, that
so,
kind of card.
You know, I was flattered. And when my kids came into town, I was sort of bragging to my son and daughter-in-law. And from the back seat, and that story went on. So then we were driving. About 10 minutes later, my 9-year-old grandson pipes up from the back. "Hey, Gramps, let me get this straight." "Yeah." "You mean to tell me those people didn't think you were old?" So, you know, it gets passed down generation to generation.
It does. Well, it's what they're surrounded with. In your book, you had talked about the entitlement epidemic. And it sounds like you've seen a lot of that in your practice.
Well, somewhat in my practice, but mostly just looking at reading the news and
society at large,
giving talks and teaching and so forth. Yeah, you know, life is really very simple. That's my belief. That's the thesis of the book. We make it complicated now because I believe life is simple, that you can make decisions and you don't have to complicate them or become, you know, paralysis by analysis. You can make the decisions, but that often they're often tough to make.
That's true.
Although it's simple, it's not not necessarily easy. You know, life is simple, but it's not necessarily easy. Well, when life decisions get tough, people tend to complicate them by looking at all kinds of variables and going on and on, over and over and over and so forth. And I just think that you don't have to do that. If you ask yourself two questions, what kind of person do I want to be, and what do I have to do right now, you'll be fine. Now, what's that got to do with
it? Now, how does that narrow down, filter down?
Yeah. Well, we've somehow the messages become, instead of, I don't know, but instead of, but often when people need to take responsibility, they're whining and getting depressed because things aren't going the way they're supposed to go. And if they would only ask those two questions, it would get straightened out. The entitlement is that, you know, I'm entitled to go to college. I'm entitled to make a living. I'm entitled to have a job. And when things don't go right, people get very depressed and don't take responsibility for it. It's as if it's somebody else's fault.
So it's a perspective, a way of looking at what you are owed, as opposed to possibly what you can give away or...
Yeah, you know, it's part of it comes from my field and then my colleagues and who overdid the self-esteem business back starting in the 80s or 70s. You know, self-esteem and this business that you're owed and you're good and everything is fine, whether you earn it or not, becomes a little destructive because self-respect comes from having earned something. And I work with kids a lot, with teenagers over the years, and it's helpful for them to know they can earn things and build a backlog of success rather than feeling that, you know, the world should be fair and life should be fair. You know, I remember when I've seen camps. I ran camps for some time. And I've seen camps where all games end in a tie.
Oh.
But that doesn't teach people about life, you know?
No, it doesn't.
You know, we're all going to fail at something. My antidote to that is just to look around, make sure nobody's hurt. Treat each day like you're learning to ski. Look around, make sure nobody's hurt. Brush yourself off, laugh at yourself, and get up and do something else or do it again until
and
you get it right.
Start creating some meaning.
Yeah.
And purpose.
I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, and start creating some meaning and purpose. Sometimes I do talk softly.
Yeah,
sorry about that.
I wish I had that problem.
Oh,
hey, Lou, let me ask you a question.
This is Tony here.
You were talking about teenagers and a feeling of entitlement. How do you kind of counterbalance that with the system that seems to evolve that has this void?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by the system.
Well, the social system that we've developed in this country. If you have an inner city environment where there's high unemployment, you know, generationally high unemployment versus, you know, a middle class, you know, rural, you know, or middle class community with, you know, successful high schools and, you know, people with a fairly easy track in life. How can you position the child of an unemployed parent in an inner city without much hope, you know, of getting a job when they finally get through high school? What can you say to them to motivate them to try? We hear stories occasionally of people that break out of that mold, but you know,
well,
so
you know,
many.
It's interesting. There's an article in either the Washington Post or the New York Times this morning. I think it was the Times. Nicholas Kristof. Apparently there's even more evidence. I was with an agency and we started a a preschool program in the inner city in Philadelphia years and years ago. Mm-hmm. Still going, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We called it a family school, which it was, because parents participated. But it started with kids, I think, 2, 3, and 4 years old, and then went into regular school, which was an after-school program for our kids in that age group. And, you know, our staff would go into schools and help them with homework and during lunchtime and so forth. Anyway, the evidence that Christoph cites follows through on that and says that kids who go to preschool do better and have more hope and more... and do get more job, more education, more jobs, mm-hmm. Than kids who don't. So the first thing is to stop hand-wringing about and stop cutting preschool education expenses. That's the first thing. The second thing is that he talks about, and I've seen myself, is that programs that build careers. Usually through community college programs, mm-hmm. really work and help people to get jobs and to at least qualify themselves to compete in a workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those programs need to be expanded.
Mm-hmm.
Those are part of it. The other part is transportation, getting people to and from, you know, improving the transportation facilities so that people can get around cities. You know, I was in Washington this past week with a group of kids. We took in to high school kids. We went to lobby their congressman on behalf of the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act.
You just went there.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And one of the things that I remembered, because I lived in Washington when the metro was started, actually, and that makes such a huge difference in people's ability to move around and to take or at least explore jobs. So there's all kinds of ways that we know work, mm-hmm. but we don't have the political will to fund them and to make them and to make sure that they are sustained.
Yes.
I like what you say, Lou. My wife's in the therapy world, and she makes a lot of comments to me about one of the big issues we've got here in this part of California, in Santa Cruz and Salinas, is that there's a gang problem, basically.
Yeah.
And
gangs. You know, this isn't, you know, the sharks and the jets from, you know, West Side Story. You know, these guys are shooting people and and stuff. And my wife's comment is that, you know, the children, you know, of gang members, you know, grow up to be gang members. And, you know, she's continually looking for some, you know, magic that can try to break that cycle. And it has to be education.
Well, there's no magic. You know, the gangs are those kids' fraternities. You know, they support these kids who... many of them have fathers in jail,
uh-huh.
or worse. Let's put it another way: the ones that are working are not the majority, at least in my experience, which is somewhat limited with gangs. But most of those kids, many of those kids, are raised by single parents, which is tough, you know. My wife and I I deal with single parents in therapy and have for years. And my wife and I always said, we have no idea how most of them are women. How the hell they ever do that? We have enough trouble raising our kids with the two of us.
Oh, I know.
So that's one of the issues, is mm-hmm. to make it feasible for fathers to stay in the picture and be active. That's the first, like, one thing. But you have to also realize that the gangs are these kids. Talk about self-respect and self-esteem. For these kids, that's what there is, and that's what motivates them to move this way. The other thing, I'm sure your wife knows more about than I do, is the role that addiction plays. and the drug yeah. play in particular. Because once a kid gets hooked, you know, there's not much that you're going to be able to do. You can't send everybody to, to rehab. And
it doesn't work for some people, too. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. You're in California. I'm not sure where I stand. I mean, I've been over and over the legalization of marijuana, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where I stand on that. But I am sure that we ought to have some serious discussion about it without the hysteria that goes into those kinds of, well, it went into health. It's going into health care, for example. You know, we don't have sober discussion in this country anymore. We have a Who can scream the loudest?
Raging discussions. How do you feel about the reform right now, or what is now law, the health care?
Well, you're asking
law.
The wrong guy. I mean, I spent the last couple decades in Canada. My kids and grandkids, two to three of them are in Canada. My wife died, my wife of 47 years died in Canada. But before she did, she underwent all kinds of testing, nuclear testing, and MRIs, and CAT scan, and then had a 7.5-hour operation before they closed her up and told us that she wasn't going to live. They said she'd have, 6 to 18 months, and she died in 20 days. So.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But the system, she stayed in the hospital with the operation, all those tests, over about a 5 or 6 month period. Both of us, I mean, I stayed in the hospital with her for 12 days and nights. When we went home, we had hot and cold running nursing service in and out of the house. The place looked like a needles clinic. We had, apparatus for her to toilet herself and take a shower. We never, I said to my son-in-law, who was a native Canadian, I said, what's this all going to cost me? Because my dad had many similar experiences at Hopkins in Baltimore.
Yes.
And, you know, they were $50,000 bills.
I know.
And Howie said to me, nothing. You're not going to pay anything. And I never did.
Wow.
And it was then I had prostate cancer. Went in the hospital. They took it. They took the prostate out. A week later, I was running again.
Wow.
I run for sanity, and I never saw a charge. So, you know, the system works if you're seriously ill. If you've got, elective surgery, there are waiting lines, and, Canadians, like everybody else, complain. But,
here you often have to wait as well.
Hello?
Here you often have to wait as well.
Well, the big thing is, my new wife and I, were in up in Edmonton a year or so ago, and it struck me because the healthcare debate was going on in this country too. It struck me that, and I said to her, "You see all these people? We were at a shop. The world's biggest shop, indoor shopping mall, is in Edmonton, Alberta."
I've heard that.
Why? Nobody knows, but it's a freak show. It's a great place, an amusement park, 11-acre wave pool. It's a great place. Anyway, I said to her, "You see all these people? It must have been 10,000 people there." "Yeah," I said. "Not one of them is worried that if they get sick, they're going to lose their house or go broke."
I know.
So the national anxiety rate
goes down.
Is diminished. And, that's item one. So I know that the system can function. Is it perfect? No. But the arrogance of Americans that we have the only and best system, which we don't, by the way, the best system in the world, when places like Denmark, Germany, Switzerland, France, all kinds of places.
Costa Rica.
Have
even
excellent
Guatemala
service.
Guatemala is catching up with us.
Yeah. Exactly. You asked the wrong guy.
No, I asked the right guy.
You'd be very welcome in Santa Cruz, Lou.
You'd
fit in very well over
you
here.
I have a friend that went to school there. I imagine what it's like.
Well, you see more tie-dye t-shirts in Santa Cruz than anywhere else on the planet, I think. But anyway.
Well, it's the only place I've ever been that had a college surfboarding team.
Yeah. Well,
high school surfboarding team, I think.
Yes.
The university's mascot is a banana slug.
You get an idea.
I have a hat with it on it. I love it.
Not a Wolverine.
Oh, from Santa Cruz.
But a very good friend of mine's a... believes in alternative medicine, and he found some data not long ago that basically said that the United States spends 50% of what the world spends on pharmaceutical medications, and we rank 37th on the World Health Organization's list of healthiest countries.
Yeah, no, I understand that. My problem is not limited. Healthcare is symptomatic to me, the discussion on healthcare, because it isn't a discussion. People have an amazing ability to ignore evidence.
That's what drives
me nuts.
They've listened to too many sound bites and taken it personally.
They have an identity with a certain
mindset.
I wonder what would happen if we didn't have a black president, frankly. I mean, I lived through the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and those kinds of things. I just wonder what role that's playing.
Why do you think it would pass if he were white?
Well, it passed, and he's black and it passed, so yeah, it would pass.
Without.
I just wonder if the venom and the vitriol would be as heightened as it is.
I don't know. You may... I don't know.
I certainly don't know, but... I got my guesses.
Yes, you do, and I can suspect where they're leading you.
Hey, Lou, let me ask you a quick personal question, because you're the second person called Hamburger that I've met in my life.
Really?
Yeah, and the other one, well, actually it's a couple that live in, I'm thinking it's either northern New Jersey or that part of Pennsylvania that butts up against New Jersey. It's a Monica Hamburger and her husband.
No, don't know.
I just thought that would be the weirdest coincidence. But
there are a number around.
Oh, okay.
But it's still good for jokes.
My sense of humor sometimes needs some fine-tuning. But I have a question about, again, the health care in Canada. And how is it funded there?
With taxes. We pay Canadians pay a higher percentage of... Well, you know what? I never did the research. I lived through it, but I never really sat down with a pen and pencil. And I'd probably get the math wrong anyway. but
just higher taxes.
I never sat down with a pen and pencil. But when you... Canadians pay a higher rate of tax, but that some of that tax comes back in the form of health benefits. In the States, we pay a maximum 38% income tax, but then we pay to the insurance companies on top of
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's very difficult to, well, it's not difficult, but it takes somebody with a better math mind than mine to actually chart that out.
And
the fact is that's a secondary issue in my head. In my head, the first issue is I do not want to live in a country where 31 million people, I think it's more than that, we're just covering 31 million with this.
I know.
But where millions and millions of people cannot afford health care and can't afford to get, never mind the health care, they can't afford to get sick.
I know.
I have a number of patients who, well, the depression rate in this country should drop with this. Because a number of people that I've seen over the years, their depression may not be caused by, but it's exacerbated by the fact they can't change jobs.
Yeah.
If they change jobs, they lose
their health care.
They lose their health insurance. Well, we're all control freaks of one kind or another, and when you lose that control over your life choices, anxiety sets in.
Yeah.
No. And that's probably understating it.
Well, it makes perfect sense when you're worried about your health and your possibly your shelter and your food, because you can lose everything with a medical condition as things stand now, even with health insurance.
I'll tell you what bothers me even more.
A sense of injustice.
is
what bothers
the the irrationality of some of the arguments. That's what I was talking about before, people's ability to ignore evidence.
Well,
if you can explain
ignorant.
To me why Medicare is a good thing for, is a good medical insurance for a government to be involved in, our government, but health care for 31 million people isn't, I mean, I'm interested. It just doesn't make sense to
no,
me.
No, it doesn't. No, the arguments don't. And I'm baffled. In the same way.
We're on the same side of the argument, unfortunately, so we don't understand
argue.
It either, Lou. But I was telling Cindy a little while ago that I pay significantly more per month in health insurance for myself and my wife than I do in income taxes.
Than you do in England?
No, than income taxes.
Oh.
Pretty much
well,
what
my health care bill is significantly higher per month than my tax bill.
Well, probably you don't make enough money.
No, all kidding aside,
what is the situation?
An arm and a leg for health insurance.
Oh, I know. What's the situation? Well, are you independently? You're independently insured.
Actually, it's through my. It's a small. I have a small business plan. I run an agency, and my wife and I are the owners, and we have a small group plan. But
yeah, look. You're preaching to the converted here. What's England like?
Well, you should have tuned in for the first hour. I was explaining.
I have a 98-year-old
mother who lives in a cross between an assisted living and a skilled nursing home in England, and she doesn't pay anything for it today because she paid her taxes when she worked.
Exactly.
She's 98 years old. She's had $7,000 worth of hearing aids in this last year. Didn't cost her a penny. And they're actually talking about the lump she has in her breast as to whether she should have elective surgery or not. She doesn't think it's a good idea, but, you know, this idea of, oh, once you're over 70, they're not going to want to do anything to help you because it's a death panel, you know, it's just absolute BS.
Well, I'm well over 70, and I know damn well it's not true.
Yeah.
Was I over 70 when I had my prostate out? Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, you know, Tony, people just don't listen. That's the problem.
Oh yeah.
You know, we don't listen to each other. You know, I'm just as upset with some of the liberal news, hardly news, whatever it is, the entertainment business that, you know, even a guy like Keith Olbermann, who I really like, I respect anyway, but I don't like that kind of, and Rachel Maddow, I don't like that kind of sarcasm.
Yeah.
And bitterness on anybody's side, even if they're on my side.
I know it. I don't either. I feel the same way.
Yeah, I mean, the discourse is just awful. And as long as that's
it's so abrasive, people are turned off by it and they cannot hear.
Yeah. Well, that's my hope, that the crazies will actually shoot somebody or something. They're already working on it. And that the predicted demise of
that.
The Democratic Party is a little bit premature.
Oh, I don't think that's the answer. Any kind of shooting is not to be recommended now, particularly in the current climate.
No.
You just said maybe if you shoot someone.
No, well, I think if the irrationality becomes that clear, maybe we can settle down to some kind of sanity. But you know, it's really no worse than it was in the 1920s,
1930s.
In the 1960s, and even in the 70s with the Vietnam
30s
War.
In Germany.
So we've survived the other stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll survive it.
Yeah, we will, for sure. So you write about filtering and how we filter our thoughts. Can you talk about that a little bit? Well, the filters that we carry around with us, our paradigms.
Yeah.
How
well, what I mean
what
by that,
see,
and
what
I call my clients and my patients, is sometimes, you know, a word by the speaker is about the speaker. Matter of fact, often it is.
Oh, yeah. It's a reflection of who someone is.
Yeah, so we filter everything. Everybody reads from their own script.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I talk about families in family therapy, I say, you know, Because most families come to family therapy as there's an expression in family therapy called the IP, the identified patient. And most families come, usually it's a kid who's acting out, and they come sort of reluctantly to family therapy, but they come because they think it'll help fix the kid. But when somebody, but often that person is acting out for the whole family. And so when that person changes, or anybody changes mm-hmm. in a family, it's like a mobile. You touch
sure.
one piece, everything moves. And it's like a dress rehearsal, you know, at a high school play. If you start ad-libbing and changing the script, people are going to push like crazy to keep you reading the script the way it's supposed to be. And that's true in life, I think, as well. That we, you know, if somebody comes along that battles our cage or starts to say things that we don't like, we push them to say it the way that we want them to say it. When in fact, they're just filtering it through their own mind, and if we recognize that, we won't get as aggravated, hopefully. Worked for me.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just the importance of being aware of what we're filtering.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's owning it.
Oh, that helps.
It certainly does. If you comes in real handy, saving it for later. And give us an example of something that can become everything. How can we avoid letting anything become everything? I mean, something that
well, addiction
that may bother
comes to
you
mind
a lot.
Real fast.
Addiction,
because that's what I worked with. Yeah, sure. I mean, an addict who's, I mean, the extreme would be an addict who's hooked on heroin or something equally habitual. They can't. They spend their days planning and plotting. Alcoholics do similar things. It's not my field of expertise, by the way, so I'm out of my league here. But that's what happens. People, one thing becomes everything. Where I get involved with people is with couples or with individuals who are falling in love, and that's all they can see is that other person. And they tailor their whole life and obsess on their other person. I mean, you think of it with high school kids and college kids first, but it's true of, you know, the general population, the adult population as well. I see a number of women who can't live without men, and
I see a lot
men
of
who
men
can't
that live can't
without
live
a particular
women
woman,
women.
And so forth. Listen, I've been obsessed. I run, and if I don't run during a for 2 or 3 days, I'll go a little wacky. So it's just a caution about letting anything, about keeping balance in your life. You know, everything is about balance. It's like health. Take health care. People are obsessed with health care. It became, you know, one thing became everything, and it has to be a certain way. John McCain is out here screaming bloody murder that he's never going to stop, you know, so forth and so on. Some of that's politics and grandstanding. But to the degree that it's not, to the degree that he's attached his whole life to that, is not healthy.
No. Wow.
Is that true of all obsessive compulsive disorders, though?
Well, sure. Yeah, but, you know, it doesn't have to be obsessive. I'm not talking about obsessive compulsive disorders where, you know, people have, they really can't help themselves. I'm talking about just normal folks like you, me, or assuming we're normal.
You speak for yourself.
You know, who just, yeah, you know, if I had spent, as I probably did in my younger days, if I had spent this entire week thinking of nothing and reading notes and doing everything because I knew I was going to talk to you guys, I think my life would have been out of whack a little bit. So, you know, it's whatever if something's taking over your life and you're finding that you can't think about other things,
Mm-hmm.
Check it out.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice.
It certainly is. You have a lot to offer, too. And you talk about determining what our personal needs are and filling them from the behaviors that we repeat. And sometimes those behaviors are counterproductive.
Yeah, all of our crazy behaviors, the self-destructive, counterproductive, whatever you call them, those behaviors are all getting us something. People don't repeat behavior for no reason. So they're getting something out of it. All of us, me too. The question is to figure out what that might be. Then you can decide maybe you can start to break that cycle. But you have to understand that you're getting something out of that behavior. It's not that behavior is just beating down on you.
True.
But I got to tell you,
what?
Every time somebody uses wisdom for something I'm saying, I think back. I have to tell you, I'm not saying much different than I did when I was 30. But when I was 30, I was working with teenagers back in the 60s. And I was told that this wisdom, what you're calling wisdom, was nuts. So, you know, that's an advantage of age. You know, the same stuff you were talking about and arguing about when you were younger, people now say, oh, yeah, wow.
You've got a little bit of gray hair, and it becomes words of wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I was quite happy my hair turned gray when I was quite young, you know, because the people thought how wise I became suddenly, you know.
Yeah.
I was in looking at your book, Lou, I noticed it's been out a couple of years. How has it been successful?
No.
Oh, what happened?
It's my fault. I'll talk on shows like this and at home, but I haven't done a damn thing to really promote it. I have a great agent, but there are limits because I don't travel and I don't, it started out as a sort of ethical will for my kids and grandkids. And then somebody at work encouraged me to turn the posters, you know, the pictures you have, the captions for each chapter, turn
to keep
that
it
into
simple and sort of sound.
Yeah, something written, a monograph or something, and that's how it came. And that was my only plan or hope. I don't really want to do what it would take to actually sell millions. Besides that, there are lots of other books out there. There's lots of stuff out there.
What I like about it is it's relatively brief. It's, you know,
it's clear.
50, 60
it's
pages. It's very easy to read. And, you know, you've not loaded it up with the psychobabble stuff. You know, it's down to earth. And I would think very useful for the families that are having issues, you know, that, you know, a family can talk about and go through a chapter or two and get some discussion.
Well, I appreciate that. I really thank you for that. But you know what? It does work. It's worked over the years. It's stood the test of time.
I believe you.
Now, how would you summarize what exactly works?
Well, there's two questions. What kind of person do I want to be? And what do I have to do right now to move that along? And the corollary question for raising kids. What kind of person do I want this character in front of me to turn out to be? And what do I have to do right now to help that happen? The reason I landed on those, I didn't. My clients taught me that when you're really up against it, when trauma, because I do a lot of trauma work, when trauma really hits, you do not run to the shelf and look in chapter 3 of the latest self-help book, including mine. So you need something, some mantra, some one-liner that can at least shake you up enough so that you can focus on what is the simple, straightforward approach to whatever you're dealing with now. And if you can ask yourself, and I accidentally discovered over the years, what kind of person do I want to be? What do I have to do right now? And that, some of that comes directly from Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. You know,
yeah.
People, if you have a sense of purpose and a mission, if you volunteer, depression recedes. There is some research on that subject, but I found it for sure. People who who are depressed, if I can get them to volunteer, and some do, they feel a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And better is not the operative word. The operative word is useful.
Yeah.
I like that.
I do too, and it's true in all ages. Whatever you're interested in to pursue, and not think of the paycheck necessarily.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with my dad told me, rich or poor, money
helps.
Nothing
wrong with the paycheck.
But there's nothing wrong with money. But I know too many people. My wife worked in one of these resorts, health centers, whatever, where the movie stars go. She's a nurse.
Spa.
which she gave up to become a nurse in a poverty middle school and feels much better about it. Because people will go to those things and they got plenty of money. They're miserable. Absolutely miserable. Talk about entitlement.
Yeah.
You know,
can
and
be.
They can't. There's a phrase known as golden handcuffs. You know what that is? That's when somebody's married to a wealthy person and they really don't love them. But they do love the money and the Mercedes and the Rolexes and the first class flights, you know. So, you know, they feel. But then they turn around and say, you're going to feel trapped. No, those are choices. Mm-hmm. That person has chosen to stay in that relationship. And believe me, lots of people choose to stay in bad places that they could get out of.
Yeah, that's a form of self-imposed imprisonment.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if, you know, it can't be imprisonment if you choose it. Nobody goes to jail voluntarily.
It probably feels like that to them, though.
Well,
a certain standard
of
living they have to maintain.
That's right, but that's not. See, I believe that the only thing. Tony, did you say your wife was a therapist?
She's an intern at the moment. She got a master's in counseling psychology, and she's done 3,000 hours of slave labor, and she's got her licensure exams to do now to get a.
Hey, man, that's just training, making her a professional.
Exactly, interns.
It's a cottage industry, this licensing business.
It's voluntary.
But anyway,
You
know, the best thing. I learned this after about 30 years in the field. The best, if not the only thing, that a therapist can do for a client is to help them see the same mess from a different platform.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the technique and schools and her internship is probably teaching her a lot of techniques, especially in California. That's fine. But if you can't connect and you can't help a person see their condition from a different perspective, all those techniques are going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't. At least that was my experience and my students' experience. That if you can help somebody say, wait a minute, you know, that does make sense, or now I see it differently. And there are all kinds of ways to do that. You can do it with psychodrama. You can do it with logic. You can do it with cognitive behavioral therapy, you can do it with rationally motive therapy, but there are all kinds of ways to help people see the same mess from a different perspective. But when you cut through all of the, what did you say, psychobabble?
Did I say that?
Oh, yeah, you did.
He did.
But when you cut through all of that, that's our contribution. It's to help people see, they can see their life from a different perspective. You know,
yeah.
One man's trash is another's treasure and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what we do. Mm. You know, sometimes we make it sound more complicated than it is, but basically that's what we do.
And that's part of being human.
Yeah, exactly.
And the humor is so important. Now, we're going to have to wrap it up in a few minutes here. But how would you? What would you like to say to our listeners in closing?
I do not know anyone who I've dealt with: depressive people, suicidal people, people in who watch their houses burn down, people in floods and hurricanes and the whole business. I've watched race riots. I've watched everything else. I do not know a single soul who exercises and finds humor and laughs a lot mm-hmm. who is depressed.
Ah, beautiful. Thank you. Yeah.
And so exercise and find something to laugh at, especially at yourself.
You know, and I can tell from sharing with you this past hour that you have a real love for people.
Yeah. Oh, are you kidding?
No.
Let me end this with a great story. At least I think it's a great story.
Okay.
I worked with a young hooker from the Northwest Territories, believe it or not, near the Arctic Circle when I was in Edmonton. And I was running a residential treatment center for adolescents, meaning bad boys and girls. So she was there, and she spent a year. And after a year, she was doing fine. Beautiful young kid, about 17 years old. So she was getting ready for discharge, and I walked into the office one day, and on my desk was a nice card to the staff saying, "We thank you, and please, Lou, please thank the staff for me. You guys were wonderful, blah, blah, blah," all that stuff. And it was a hockey card, a Joe Nieuwendyk hockey card. Either of you hockey fan?
Yes, I am. So I know who yeah. Joe Nieuwendyk is.
Joe Nieuwendyk is a Hall of Famer for the Dallas Stars. Anyway, so I said to her, so I walked over to the cottage where she was living, and I said, "Thanks for the card, I appreciate it, but what's this thing? Are you a hockey fan?" "Well, no." I said, "Are you a relative of Joe Nieuwendyk? In Canada, everybody knows somebody in the NHL." "No." "Are you a fan?" "No." I said, "Well, what is this thing?" She said to me, "Lou, you're not going to believe this, but when I was on the street and feeling violated and vulnerable and yucky, this stupid card was the only thing that kept me from feeling any more violated than I already was. And I'm not going back to that life, so you guys have helped me, and you've helped me, so I want you to have it." I said, "Boy, that's really nice. I really appreciate
Why
that.
Why you?
Does that mean you want me to work the street?"
That was my question,
and she looked
too.
Me square in the eye and said, "Lou, you'd never earn a dime."
There you go.
Oh, humor as part of life works.
It certainly does. And much more. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us, Lou.
Thanks
and let's
you.
See if we can get some copies of your book. You need to get it out there. Can't Find the Willpower. Everything You Should Have Learned Since Kindergarten. And thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. Good luck, Tony.
Yeah, thank you. Good luck to you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, that was Lou Hamburger, author of Can't Find the Willpower. He's from Tucson, Arizona, and we certainly heard his opinions on healthcare. I can certainly agree with those. And now we're going to hear, let's see, what do we have lined up? I was going to put on We Are All From the Goddess, but I think I want to put on The River Sings.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Now we're into the third hour of Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. I'm Janaea, and with me today is Tony. And our third guest is John Quinn, and he just wrote a book entitled Someone Like Me, An Unlikely Story of Challenge and Triumph Over Cerebral Palsy. He was born with cerebral palsy, and in spite of his partial paralysis, two different sized feet, and the inability to walk prior to the age of four, he was still able not only to find employment, but retired at the age of 40 after an extremely successful 20-year career with the United States Navy. That's amazing, given CP. And he did it while keeping his condition a complete secret, out of a deep desire, like all of us feel, to be treated just like everyone else. And I've worked with folks with disabilities as well, and Tony still does, and we know the fear of being laughed at because you're different. So this book is for anyone who feels that. And he's tremendous, and I want to welcome him onto the show now. John, hi.
John? Hey, how are you?
Oh, wonderful. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's what you're listening to here.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. And the first question I have, you were in the Navy. How did you pass the physical? I know they're quite challenging.
You know, I actually failed my first physical to join the Navy.
Wow.
Made it through the long day of the physical, up there, right until the end, where, you know, there's 50 guys in this room, and they said, okay, the last exercise that we're going to make you do is this duck walk exercise.
And, a what
where
walk?
You get down in your catcher, like a catcher squat, put your arms out, and I tried to do that, and I was so weak I couldn't hold up my own body weight. So I fell over, shaking, and the doctors come over and looked at me and said, what's wrong with you? Nothing. Try that again.
Dear.
And I tried it again. Failed miserably, so they looked at me and said, son, we don't know what's wrong with you, but we don't want somebody like you in the Navy. Go home.
Oh.
So the next day, down in my basement, I started working with that working on that exercise, and pulled out some tools, physical therapy tools of my childhood, and did that every day for a year.
Wow.
And I went back. And I was the best duck walker in the whole building, I'll tell you.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow.
Thank you.
And, you know, with CP, it must be a daily struggle, too, for you. I mean, the pain, I imagine. And
It is. You know, but every case of cerebral palsy is different.
Uh-huh.
But for myself, I'm very fortunate to have a relatively mild case of CP.
Mm-hmm.
But every morning when I wake up, I put the pain away. I lock it away in my mind, and I don't let it affect me. I do what I want to do to the best of my abilities and live a full and productive life.
Yes, you have. You still are, I'm sure.
It's Tony here, John. It's nice to meet you.
Hi, Tony.
I work with families with persons with developmentally disabled developmental disabilities. Excuse me. And cerebral palsy is one of those covered conditions. And I've seen that it's such a spectrum disorder in the sense that people can be very severely affected. You know, to people that have relatively mild effect. But you know what you've accomplished here is quite outstanding.
Yeah, it is.
And to be able to keep that a secret, you know, from everybody, you know, for 20 years in the military is just pretty amazing. It must have taken its toll on you, though, you know, emotionally and mentally, to be able to keep on your game 100% of the time, I presume.
Well, that's spot on right there. It was a challenge both physically and mentally for me, you know, mentally mm-hmm. just as much as physically, because, you know, you want to portray yourself a certain way. You have to portray yourself a certain way, and the way that I had to do that was always be aware of my surroundings and also of my body,
mm-hmm.
and literally have to tell my body to move a certain way, pick up my feet to set them down, hold my arms and legs in certain positions.
Wow.
And to do that for 20 years, that was a challenge. The physical challenge also, living life on board a ship, which I served on several, that would also took its toll, but the mental side of it was really, I think, the toughest challenge of them all.
Did you share with any of your shipmates, or was it something that you, through fear of being, exposed to the management, shall we say, did you keep it totally secret to yourself?
I did keep it totally secret.
Wow.
No one knew until I finished my manuscript and passed it over to some of my shipmates, and I said, "Here, read this. Let me know what you think."
What was their reaction?
they said, well, first of all, they were astonished. But secondly, I believe it answered some questions that they might have had in their minds. But bottom line is, they said, you were an outstanding sailor. This doesn't change anything about that. You stood every watch. You had tough, demanding duties. And this just shows us more about you as a human being, more than anything. And we commend you for your service. So I was really great. I was really glad to get that reaction.
What about the senior officers' side? I can understand that reaction from your shipmates. What about the senior officers?
Yeah.
What did they think of it?
Well, that's I actually showed the manuscript and told my story to some senior officers first.
Uh-huh.
And, they basically had the same reaction.
Oh, that's cool.
They said, "Senior Chief, you're a great sailor." And to know this about you, it doesn't change anything about you other than the fact that your fortitude and your perseverance shows through in this story. That to me, that's a testimony of my career and the hard work. But they were definitely surprised. I'm not, pleasantly so.
Right. Well, that's good. Did you say you made senior chief? Was that your rank?
Yeah, E1.
Senior chief is an E8. You can go all the way up to E9 within the enlisted ranks.
Uh-huh.
Everybody starts out as an E1, which is a seaman recruit.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you work your way through. I made E8 in 14 years, which is very, very quick.
Mm. And what is it? You were a plunk owner of SEAL Team 3. What is that?
A plank owner is someone who is there to help set the unit up, whether it's a ship. In my case, it was the SEAL team. You're there helping organize the unit and getting it ready so that it's ready for commission. Like you would commission a ship, you see the large ships being commissioned into the water. With the SEAL team, you help set everything up, and then you have the commissioning ceremony, and then in Navy tradition, I would be given a plank of the ship.
As
a token of my time on board. I'm an all part owner of that ship or that unit.
I understand. And you also won, or were granted, earned, is the word, numerous decorations, including four Navy commendation medals, Joint Service Achievement Medal, and four Navy Achievement Medals on top of having CP. This is incredible.
Well, thank you. I was fortunate enough to work with a lot of great sailors who helped me along the way, and all those decorations are a testimony to those shipmates that I worked with.
Yeah.
I take a lot of pride in my career.
What kind of ships were you on, John?
Well, I served on numerous types of ships. My first ship was an amphibious ship, a flat-bottom marine troop carrier.
Mm-hmm.
I served on a naval destroyer, two aircraft carriers, a battleship, and worked on numerous staff duties, including the Pacific Fleet Admiral and down at U.S. Central Command down at Tampa, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You said battleship. You mean something like in Iowa or New Jersey?
Yes, sir. I served on board the USS Iowa.
Awesome.
Wow.
I remember seeing the Iowa up in San Francisco a few years back, and I was just amazed at how low in the water, you know, it was tied up against the pier. You know, people were going down onto the ship, whereas, you know, with an aircraft carrier, you know, you're going up a huge, you know, height to get to the deck. And with the Iowa, it was actually going down, you know, the ramp to it. It was just caught me as
a... on board the Iowa was indeed a great honor for me. To be known as a battleship sailor is something that all sailors would love to have been part of the resume.
Right. I have no personal experience of serving in the military, but a very good friend of mine is an old sailor from Pearl Harbor who served on the Nevada, lived here in Santa Cruz, who passed away a few years ago, but told me numerous stories of his exploits. And he was I don't know how he got in the Navy because he wasn't very tall, but he got in okay, and he was just a character. And when he died, he was in his 80s, and he still had a flat top.
What's that? What's a foe?
Once a sailor, always a sailor.
Right, and yeah, the guy was just
still in your jeans.
The guy was just a character all the way through. And I remember going on vacation to Hawaii and did the tour of Pearl Harbor and picked up a couple of souvenirs. And I remember, you know, the pride in his face, you know, when he said to me, "Oh, that's where we were. That's where we were, and that's how we got the Nevada off, and that's where it got stuck on the mud bank, and they made us." He was really ticked off because whoever was in charge that day insisted, because his ship had been hit, that they weren't allowed to try and get it out the channel lest they sink in the channel and block it.
Sure.
So they had to beach it, you know, and he was really miffed about that. He thought he could get out there and go charging around the ocean looking for the guys. You know. He was just a character.
That's so quite a story.
Yeah, the guy was just full of him, but he had the license plate with Pearl Harbor Survivor, you know, on it, and you know, and he used to tell me the stories of every year they'd have the reunions in the Monterey Bay area, and how each year there were less and less people there.
Yeah. Oh, my father, too, until he passed away. He was a captain, and my grandfather was an admiral in the Navy, and they would always share stories, and they would constantly be talking and meeting other Navy seamen, even merchant marines.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do when you get out of the Navy, John?
I'm sorry?
What did you do when you got out of the Navy?
Well, I went to work for a bank for a while and lived in San Diego, and...
Oh.
But I went home to my home state of Michigan, the Detroit area, and decided to sit down at a computer one day and started banging on this story, and I've been pretty much working on that ever since.
Ah, and you write in your book that you worked with the administrator of pain, and what kind of therapy did you do, and for how long?
You know, the therapy that I did as an 11-year-old is a lot different than the therapy that they go through now. Back in the early 70s, the tool that I used for my physical therapy was pretty complex. It was surgical rubber tubing, real thick stuff. And the administrator of pain, she would cut a length of it, tie it in a circle, and loop it around my legs. And I'd have to stretch it out wide and walk around the room with this rubber tubing stretched out across my legs. Looked like a drunk cowboy just getting off his horse. And then
Ouch.
She would take that same rubber tubing and put it over my forearms, and I'd have to stretch it across my chest to do my upper body work.
Well, it paid off because you were a wrestler in junior high school. And what was that like?
You know, that was a great experience. Even though I lost every match I ever wrestled, it's my claim to fame. I think my career record was 0-79. But, you know, just like the military, I didn't tell my teammates on the team about my CP or my condition, you know, because I just wanted to be known as a wrestler. One guy on a team of 35 guys, and but my dad told me, "Hey, go ahead, you know, you can join the team. Just don't come home crying if it's too hard, and you know, don't quit." So I didn't quit, and I learned some valuable life lessons on that mat, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I bet you did. Allowed you to continue forward regardless of the obstacles.
I don't know.
Well, sometimes a victory is in the attempt, you know, and not in your win and loss record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, you know, how many of our listeners really know what it's like with cerebral palsy. I know before I got involved with this kind of work, I was, I had very little knowledge of it. But I've seen, I remember a case of a little boy who was 4 years old, totally immobile, spent his entire life basically in a child seat, strapped in, and succumbed to the condition before his fourth birthday, I guess. His body just couldn't cope with the breathing, just couldn't get enough breath in, and from one extreme, and it's such a concern. I mean, I can tell you the story of a situation. There was a young man, everybody's a young man compared to me these days. He was 45 years old, and his mother was 80, and she had looked after him for 45 years. And he was wheelchair bound. He had very little muscle tone waist down, but had a strong upper body. So he pumped iron, got his biceps up, and his mother and people had a basketball hoop put out in the backyard, and prop him up in his wheelchair, and he'd shoot baskets with people. But she was an 80-year-old lady who looked after him for 45 years.
Amazing.
And she was just an amazing lady, but her biggest fear in life was what was going to happen to him when she died. And fortunately, here in California, we have a tremendous support program for persons with developmental disabilities. And in the end, actually, her decision-making got rather shot because she had developed, one of the aging-related dementia conditions and wasn't making good decisions. So they ended up having an intervention for her, not for drug and alcohol, but for her ability to look after her son.
Yeah.
And eventually they placed him in a residential setting, and she moved into an assisted living half a mile down the road. So she still got to see him. But she knew that he was in a safe place. And he actually started to thrive, away from her total love.
And that's remarkable.
Well, but the ladies, I just had absolute admiration for this lady to teach. He was nonverbal as well, but she taught him a couple of hundred words of vocabulary that he could recognize from signs, and she developed what looked like a huge Ouija board that she would mount on his wheelchair. And the words were geared up with the different sort of activities of daily living, like bathing and dressing and eating. Mm-hmm. And so she would have some choices for clothes, and like blue and red and, sweaters and shirts and similar for choices for food. And he could help, kind of point to the ones that he wanted, but he wasn't able to articulate that. It was just an amazing experience. And, that's at one end of the spectrum, and, at the other end of the spectrum, you had this incredible accomplishment. So I think it's just
amazing.
Just amazing, yes.
And what was it?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and what was it like growing up with CP? What were some of your experiences and feelings? And
well, my childhood was similar, I think, in a lot of ways. I have seven brothers and sisters. We grew up and we had one bathroom in the house, and we played football out in the street and home run derby in the backyard. But I teased my sisters a lot, like brothers would do. But I had to go through the physical therapy all through grade school, and I was different. I wore eye patches at night to help correct my vision. Because cerebral palsy affects the muscles in my eyes, so my eyes used to wander, and used to have this patch regimen that I would go through, and I would wear long pants all the time to hide my legs, and still got teased and picked on and bullied and called names, and so it was. You learn to grow a pretty thick skin at a young age.
Sure.
So there were a lot of challenges growing up.
Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to others overcoming obstacles?
You know, I guess what I would say is, you know, we all face challenges, you know. But, it, you know, the success that we have in our lives is accomplished through the effort that we put forth. You know, and you can succeed, whether it's one step at a time, one push-up at a time, or one day at a time. You know, there's always hope. Don't let anybody, you know, give up on yourself or your dreams, you know, and find a way. People with disabilities don't want to be known as people with disabilities. They want to be known as people.
Sure.
And, you know, that's the message of my book.
Mm-hmm.
You can succeed if you're willing to put forth the effort. And with equal opportunity comes the chance for greatness.
Well, so many people are into the instant gratification. You know, what you're talking about really is that this effort that's required is effort, it's perseverance, and it's this concept of, you know, how do you eat an elephant? You know, the answer's bit by bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. you're not going to go from A to Z. You've got to go through B, C, and D on the way.
So that's exactly right. You know, the success lies in the attempt. You know, don't tell me that you can't do something if you haven't tried it. Give it a try. And if you fail, then, hey, at least you tried. And that's something that I've always kept in the back of my mind, you know. People laughed at me when I told them I was going to write a book. You've never done that before. Well, okay, I'm going to give it a try, and look where we are today.
And it's going to be coming out April 15th.
April 15th. I'm very excited. Available for pre-order now, and, you know, the
Someone
response
like
that I'm getting
me.
From people around the world has just been fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to reading it myself. But another question I had was, how did you deal with the pain?
You know, I learned a lesson working with the Navy SEALs because if you're ever around those guys, they can pain for them is something that they deal with, and you know, it's just weakness leaving their body is what they'll tell you. So I asked one of my roommates, I said, "How do you do that?" And he taught me the little trick of compartmentalization, where you literally envision for myself, I envision a strong steel box, and every morning I literally put my pain in that box, and nobody can ever touch that box. But the power of the mind is really something that it's taken a long time for me to master that. It's something that I use, and but the pain does come in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It leaks through sometimes, and especially at night when you're tired.
Mm-hmm.
I try and just to ignore it and focus on what I need to get done.
Wow. And probably thinking of the accomplishments and what you will be putting forth for you.
That's right. You know, I don't try and dwell on the past. And what I've done, I'm always trying to look forward to the future, and you know, how I can improve my situation, whether it's working out or you know, my day-to-day existence. What can I do to better myself? I'm always focusing on that instead of, you know, what I've accomplished. Because what I've accomplished, that's great, but how can I move forward? And that's why I'm so excited about this book, because I really believe it's going to be able to help so many people.
Yeah.
And that gives me so much excitement looking forward.
And I understand that you talk openly, you write openly, about the suicide of your brother Stephen and of his battle with alcoholism and your battle. And mm-hmm. Now, why did you decide to put these subjects in the book?
Well, you know, just like where I needed so much help as a child with my physical therapy, I learned in dealing with the suicide of my brother and my alcoholism that I also needed help in those areas as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get that help. So hopefully somebody can read those pages and realize that, hey, there's help out there for me too. And then I encourage people to get help and the support if they need it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I like the reference that you make that the book is not just for the person that has the CP, but also for the families that have children with CP. On one hand, you know, the hope that they have for the future, that mythical, you know, concept that they'll wake up one morning and it won't be a problem anymore, to, you know, coming up with a strategy that can help them accept, you know, the condition. And, you know, if they can accept the condition, then they're going to be one step, I guess, towards helping their child accept the condition and then work on a plan to deal with it.
Well, that's exactly right. One of the reasons why I wrote the book is that I saw that there was a gap in current literature. There wasn't really anything out there written by an adult with CP saying, hey, here's what I've got, here's how I live my life, and here's the hope that you can possibly, you know, gain from this. You know, most of the books that I saw were geared towards babies and infants, and you know, you have dry medical journals out there. You know, but I learned by sharing my story that a lot of parents are dealing with people that like to put up barriers in their lives and tell them, well, this is the way it's going to be. This is the future for your child. And you know, they like to deal in these absolutes. Well, okay, I like to think that the future is unwritten. You know, and you can succeed. Whether your success is being able to walk without limping, or, you know, whatever your success might be, it is your success. Don't let somebody limit what you can do, because I'm here to tell you, if you listen to those people, you're going to get it in your mind that, well, this is the best I can do. This is the way my life is going to be. And
how true.
I don't like to think like that.
Yep. And in the beginning, well, throughout your career, why did you want to keep it a secret after you were you'd proven yourself?
Well, you know, once you start a career like that, and you know, on a foundation of that lie, you just have to keep it. You have to keep it up, because if I would have gone to Navy officials and said, look, I was born with cerebral palsy and, you know, I've had it all along, I don't know what the ramifications would have been. They possibly would have told me to go home. I don't know. But I was 18 years old. I wanted to serve my country, and I believed it was the best course of action for me. True or not, I don't know. But it's the course that I took, and you know, I just wanted also, I wanted a level playing field. I didn't want anybody's sympathy. I didn't want to be looked at as anything different than one sailor out of 5,000 on a carrier or 1,500 sailors on a battleship. You know, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be equal in the eyes of my friends.
And you achieved it.
Yeah, and I was able to achieve it. And I'm very proud of the legacy that I have as far as training all the sailors that work for me. And, you know, some of them are still on active duty right now. One that I trained, molded, and led during my 20-year career, and that's what I'm most proud of.
Yeah.
How long have you been out, John?
Oh, heck, can you believe it's been, this October, it'll be 8 years since I retired.
Wow. Do you miss it?
You know what I miss? I miss being a chief petty officer and dealing with the young sailors. Mm. And, you know, there's nothing better for me than having a group of 18-year-old minds to show them, you know, hey, this is the way that I've done it. This is the way that I've succeeded. And if you, you know, follow my example and the example of all chief petty officers, you too can be success also, and to see them succeed, gives me the greatest gratitude in the world.
Oh, I bet. And what does it take to succeed in the Navy?
Well, I would say, as a former chief petty officer, I would say listen to your chief petty officer. That's what I would say. Listen to the chief. The chief is always right. But if I was to give any advice, I would say listen to the winners. You know, find a mentor, somebody who's successful, and learn what made them successful.
Well, what specifically would they say, I don't know much about the military. I'm actually a pacifist, an ardent pacifist. So, although my family has been in the military for years, and I come from that background, part of my family. The rest of us are Quakers. Interesting. Mm-hmm. What makes a successful besides being obedient? But
not obedient so much. But I would say, you know, you have to figure out for yourself what you want. Find something that you enjoy doing. Hang out with the successful people and keep a positive attitude. You know, and you can study hard, pass these advancement exams, and challenge yourself to succeed. That's what I would do.
You could pretty much take that across any field. It's not just restricted to the Navy, is it, John? I mean, if you applied that same concept in industry, you know, in healthcare, in whatever field you're involved in, you know, that's pretty much a guideline for success.
Well, and I think that's why so many veterans are so successful once they leave the branch of the military, and you know, the corporations of today would love to hire so many veterans because they have those tools already in place.
They do.
I've seen it. I spent 30 years in the electronics industry before I sort of turned my life around and got into healthcare. But I've seen a lot of, you know, former military people, you know, come into the electronics industry, and one of the characteristics, you know, was team player, you know, recognizing, you know, roles of authority and so forth, and as well as the reliability aspects. But one of the problems in industry now, as I'm sure a lot of former military people are finding, is that corporations seem to have abandoned the idea of middle management. You know, you're either an entry-level guy or you're the top guy. You know, and they don't seem to have anybody in the middle anymore. You know, people are either in their 50s running the company, you know, or they're in their 20s, just come out of university. And so those positions that used to be there for retired military people to come in and bring that expertise and leadership and so forth just don't seem to be around as much as they used to be. Does that kind of fit how you see it?
Yeah, you know, it is. But the benefit of having somebody in the military in your organization is they've started out on the ground floor, and they've worked their way through being, you know, the low guy on the totem pole all the way up. If you're a chief petty officer or senior chief petty officer, you are upper management, but you have worked your way through. And the other thing about a military person is their adaptability to any situation. You know, if you're out in the middle of the ocean on a destroyer, it's something doesn't work, you can't pick up the phone and call
You don't have AAA out there.
you've got to think for yourself and adapt, and that's a skill set that I think is badly needed in today's workforce.
Oh, it is. To learn how to.
This whole idea of, you know, taking middle management out of the equation, I think is a great travesty. I think it's a terrible mistake because companies have no history, they have no longevity. People have, you know,
they have no commitment, tie to the firm.
People haven't been there for 10 or 20 years.
No reason to really care about what happens to it.
I came from a culture where it was very common for people to work for one company their entire life, and I remember meeting American colleagues in the semiconductor industry, and they said, "You mean you've only worked for this one company? You know, that's not thought of very highly around here, because, you know, we think you gain more experience going from A to B to C to D." And in my career, 30-year career, I worked for the same company for 16 years, And then for the last 14 years, I worked for about 10 companies, you know. And I think looking back on it, it was insanity. Total insanity. Yeah. You know, there was no tradition. There was no continuity. You know, the military, you know, in the military, you had that level of continuity, even though people may change the systems and the procedures, they evolve over time, you know, and they're not jumping from A to, you know, over here and jumping over there and doing something.
And I imagine there's more of a camaraderie, a team spirit, where you really do grow to care for one another.
Or you rely on one another, I think.
That's the difference, and therefore you have to.
I've got you back.
Their survival depends upon yours, and vice versa.
Well, that's exactly right. If you have a fire on board a ship, and you're in the middle of the ocean, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you've got to know that the sailor next to you is going to grab that fire hose and know what to do, and it will save your life. There's a definite spirit of teamwork.
So watching the deaths must be that much more difficult. Well, it's always difficult, but
teamwork's even more important if you're in a submarine, and that's on fire, isn't it?
You know, I'm 6'3", so I've never been on a submarine, but those sub sailors are very unique breed. I give a lot of credit to those guys. That is really something to live that life.
I've done a tour through one, and you know, for a half an hour or an hour or something, and you know, I certainly wouldn't like to be, you know, out for a 6 week patrol in one. That would, you know.
And I'm
not driving me crazy.
I could probably make some phone calls. We could probably set something up. You know?
I think I'm a little too old for that now.
Oh, I don't know, Tony. You might start making those calls. Oh, boy.
How are you promoting the book, John? Are you doing the book tour kind of thing, or are you just doing an occasional spot here and there? What are your plans?
I'm planning to go home, my home state, for a couple of weeks and do a lot of media stuff here.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I appeared yesterday on Good Morning Arizona, a local morning talk show here that was seen throughout the state, and doing a lot of radio stuff, speaking to a lot of school kids around the state, which I love to do, and you know, telling them the message of, hey, you can achieve great things if you work hard and that kind of stuff. So some newspaper stuff, but I'm just excited. It's wonderful.
It certainly is.
Do you have plans to get on the kind of like motivational speaker kind of tour?
Well, I would love to be able to get on a speaking tour where I could, you know, tell my message and spread the word, and that would be great.
I'm just rattling my crystal ball here, and I think I can see something like that in your future. You know,
make some phone calls for me, will you? hook me up.
I know a lady that works for my organization who's what's a lady witch called?
I don't know.
She's a coven or something. She's into this kind of unusual spiritual.
Pagan.
Something like that. I'm really not very good at these alternative arrangements. Maybe she's just a witch. Wiccan?
Wiccan, sure.
Wiccan, there we go. Sorry, my apologies to all the
Santa Cruz
crew of witches out there. But bless her, you know, she gives me good advice when it comes to, you know, predicting the future. You know, she'll shake a few bones for me. So
and it works.
But no, I think you carry such a tremendous message.
You do.
And it's also very unique that I think you have an absolute great opportunity to, you know, to do what you want to do, which is make an impact. And
there's so many circles that you can impact.
Yeah, I mean,
vets themselves.
I cruise in the mornings and I hear on the radio that one day a week they always have a kind of a review books, and you know, they talk about book tours and people come into Santa Cruz to the local bookstore, and you know, they sell a couple of dozen books and sign a few autographs and, you know, talk for 20 minutes and, you know, oh, it must be Tuesday we're in Phoenix, you know, Wednesday we're in Dallas, you know, whatever. And that sounds to me like a pretty hard way of doing it, but it's the way people get their word out. Make appearances when they can on radio and TV, but know, the idea of getting on that the Tony Robbins type motivational speaking, you know,
and you never know who you'll touch, and you'll have your own unique character, your own unique way of presenting.
Well, that's why I enjoy talking to you guys. You got such good ideas.
Well, if I didn't have a job already, I'd volunteer to be your agent. You know, I think you're a very marketable commodity. I think you've got such a great story.
Well,
thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It means a lot to me for you to say that. Thank you.
Well, you've earned it. You really have.
Let me ask you a question about developmental disabilities. You're currently based in Tucson, in Arizona, did you say?
Yeah, I live in Tucson.
You live in Tucson. What does the state of Arizona provide, you know, support services for people with developmental disabilities? Do you know anything of that? Are you keyed into that world at all?
Not yet. That's something that I'm researching now, but not fully up on all that. So I really can't comment on that. Not yet, anyway.
Interesting area for you to perhaps investigate. I mean, here in California, we have a very
extensive
support program for persons with developmental disabilities. There was a very interesting, you know, a state assemblyman, a guy called Frank Lanterman, who got an act passed about 35 years ago now. And I'm paraphrase, but the act is written in the sort of language that sounds like the Bill of Rights. You know, it's an inalienable right of every person with a developmental disability to be treated as normal, etc., etc., etc. And it's the only act of its kind that they've passed in California. I think they wised up after they put it through, because it actually has a mandate provision that the state has to fund this program. It isn't a budget option each year that they decide whether to fund it or not.
Thank goodness they did.
And it's, you know, it's this core support program. And as I say, they never passed another one like it, because to actually change it would be very un-American, because it's actually taking away this person's rights. And so nobody wants to go in there and mess with it. But so they...
No, they've tried.
But they wised up. But the program is geared around... autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, mental retardation, and seizure disorders. Those are what are classified as the developmental disorders. And recognizing that a number of these are spectrum conditions, like the autism spectrum, and you have various milder versions, like Asperger's syndrome and so forth, that you know, there's various levels of support. And people have moved to California with their special needs children, just to tap into these programs. Yeah. And I'm always curious to know what other states do and if they have such programs. For example, in a couple of weeks' time, the local regional center, that's the organization that administers these services on behalf of the state of California for a four-county region here, is having what we call a legislative breakfast. And we invite all the local senators and state senators and assemblymen and and then even the federal politicians to come and meet and listen to and hear stories and interact with persons with developmental disabilities and the support team that provides that help. And, success stories are just so powerful in convincing the legislative officials, to continue to support programs. And your story,
you up when we need to make a tour to Sacramento.
But, within the state of, Arizona, I'm sure that, there are people that could really benefit from your story.
Meeting with them,
As well as other veterans. Have you connected with many other veterans?
I'm just beginning to do that now. Been wrapped around the axle as far as getting this book ready to go. I look forward to meeting with a lot of veterans groups in the future, not only here in Arizona, but in California and all around the country.
Right.
And going into the hospitals, too, and working with those that are now disabled as a result of their experience.
Of course.
That would
anything that I can
excellent.
Do to give back to great Americans,
Yes.
How long did it... you said you were out of the Navy for 8 years. How long did you spend writing the book, John?
About 4 years.
Okay. And was that
four years.
Was that a I mean, I've never written a book, and I dread to think how long it would take me to put it all together. I could dictate one, probably, but I'm sure I couldn't write one. Sorry. I had to get that in before Janaea got that one in.
But I'm keeping my mouth shut.
Was that a full-time, you know, 40-hour-a-week kind of assignment? Or, you know, was it something that you did for a spell and then put down and then picked up? Or, you know, how did that process go for you?
You know, that was an interesting question, because when I sat down, started writing the book, it just kind of flowed right out of me.
Uh-huh.
I told myself, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to treat it like a job. Mm-hmm. So I would sit at the computer for 4 or 5 hours every day.
Right on.
And sometimes I would write.
Very
sometimes
disciplined.
I would just sit and think. Mm-hmm. You know? But that was a process that I did. And then I was fortunate enough, I have my sister, who is a whiz with the English language, and she's kind enough to edit my day's work. So I would send her an email, my sister Susan.
Uh-huh.
And shoot her an email and say, okay, here's today's writing. Let me know what you think. And she would send it back, offer suggestions. And it took me about a year and a half to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest part for me in the whole process was finding an agent, a literary agent, which is, I knew nothing of the publishing business.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know how to proceed. Once I thought that I had a manuscript that I was proud of, and knew that I'd done my best. Okay, mm-hmm. What's next? So I literally Googled, what do I do now that I finished my manuscript?
Oh.
Found out how to proceed. Everything from a query letter to a book proposal. How do you put a book proposal together? And it took me a year just to find an agent.
Wow.
No, I can believe that. I mean, it's interesting. You wrote the book and then looked for an agent. I think maybe I don't have the military mindset. Maybe I would have looked for the agent first and then thought about writing the book.
To know that you've got backup there.
Yeah, because it would have driven me crazy if I'd have written a book. You know, so 3 or 4 years writing a book and then can't find anybody to publish it.
But it makes sense, because that's how you've done so much in your life. You've set the goal and then done what you had to accomplish it.
Thank you. And, you know, when I first started writing, I just thought that I would put my thoughts down on paper and maybe my nieces and nephews would read it one day. That was really my mindset, was not to really write something for publication, but just to put down my thoughts and leave a legacy that my family would be proud of.
Right.
And now we can hold. Now we can give them a book that's coming out soon, which is something beyond my wildest dreams.
So it can inspire so many more.
And Uncle John can sign it for him.
It sounds like the muse got a hold of you.
Yeah, and it's amazing what you, for myself, you know, the only advice that I was given when I started writing was to write like you talk. Like you're talking to a friend. I think one of the unique features of my story is the way that I write is I use a lot of dialogue. So it's not a dry memoir where I was born and da-da-da-da. You know, there's actual conversations with people, and for me that was the best way to portray emotion. So there's there's a lot of emotion in this book. There's a lot of... growing up in the 60s and the 70s, and people who grew up in that era will chuckle at some of the things that I talk about. Growing up and driving around in a big station wagon with no seat belts and both parents smoking in the front seat.
I do remember
those
that
kind of stories, you know.
And you, by the sound of it, you had a pretty big family. You had a bunch of brothers and sisters.
Eight, did you say?
There's eight of us.
Station wagon.
Yeah.
Dogs and
yeah,
cats.
I tell everybody I joined the Navy to get some privacy, you know.
I thought you wanted a square meal.
Yeah.
You had a number of reasons.
Yeah, he said you could eat as much as you want. I said, I'm sticking around.
I'll do what it takes.
Exactly.
Oh, I can. I'm an only child, John, so I have absolutely no idea what it must have been like having 7 or 8 children. You know, being an only child's kind of a fun thing because you get all the attention, and that certainly seemed to go well for me. But you know, my wife has, you know, brother and sister, and you know, I just know that, you know, there's something in life I've missed. And you know, when I meet people that have, you know, from a large family, you know, such as yours was, you know, I'm sure that the I mean, good and bad, you know, it must have been a trip, you know.
You got all the attention. I got all the hand-me-downs.
I just couldn't imagine, you know, being 7 deep and waiting to get into the bathroom, you know.
Oh, I can't. With cousins.
I got woken up in shifts.
Just like the Navy.
Exactly.
Time to
No wonder you did well at the Navy. You were schooled at it from birth.
Was your family supportive? I'm curious when you decided to go in.
Oh, yes, as a matter of fact. You know, when I told them that I decided to join the Navy, they were like, sure, go ahead. You know, good luck to you. Hmm. Because that's the way that I was raised. You know?
Oh, just go for it.
My cerebral palsy was never an issue in our household. It was just something that was dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if I wanted to try something, okay. Give it a try. And
wonderful.
You know, unfortunately, my father passed away 1 year into my career.
Oh,
My mom, she couldn't have been prouder.
She
was there when they decommissioned Iowa. She mm-hmm. was in the crowd sitting next to some U.S. senator, feeling right at home. And when I got promoted to chief petty officer, my mom and my sister Susan pinned down my anchors. So... yeah, she was a proud Navy mom, for sure.
Rightly so.
Thank you.
Rightly so. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up now. Our next news report is on Palestinian news. Then we're going to have a birthday fundraiser this Saturday that I need to announce. And then we've got the other news shows. But I really want to thank you for your amazing story and for coming on and sharing it with us. John, keep us posted as to how you're doing and stay in touch.
I think we just need to keep an eye out because we're going to see this guy around a lot, I think. I think we're going to... I'm going to be looking... I'm going to have to start recording Oprah, I think. You know, I see Oprah in your stars.
Give her a call for me. Tell her that I want to talk to her, okay?
The only problem with that is you have to give away like 500 books to all the people in the audience.
That's okay.
But then the next week, 5 million gets sold. So, you know, it's a
plan.
There
you go.
It's a plan.
There you go. Well, I'll tell you, I appreciate your time. You guys are great.
Oh,
and,
sure.
Had a lot of fun. But
thank you so much,
thank
John.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
A great story, John. Bye-bye.
All right.
Best of all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, that was John Quinn, author of Someone Like Me, and a likely story of challenge and triumph over cerebral palsy. And what a story he had to share. And he's just getting started. He'll probably be writing sequels in the not-too-distant future. Well, thank you all for listening. I'm not sure who was able to hang in there for the whole 3 hours, but Tony and I certainly enjoyed it. And now we have a little birthday announcement. And then Palestinian news. Thank you.
Coming up March 27th, Free Radio Santa Cruz is having their 15th birthday, and we'd like you to attend. So come on down to the Kumbwa Jazz Center, 302 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. We're going to have a raffle for pirate booty. We're also going to have a prize for the best pirate costume. So dress up and come on down to our birthday party. Get some birthday cake. There'll be music by Superior Olive and Sweet Jam and a bunch of other folks. As a very special guest, we're going to be having Tom Lodge, one of the first pirates on Radio Caroline, is going to be stopping by and talking to us about the early days of pirate radio. Save Saturday, March 27th, on your calendar at the Kumbwa Jazz Center, 302 Cedar Street, for Free Radio Santa Cruz's 15th birthday. We'll ask for a donation at the door, and we'll even give you double raffle tickets for every dollar you contribute above $10.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, March 23rd, 2010. Settlers attack farmers in the West Bank as Israeli tanks invade border areas in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli military released on Tuesday at dawn Omar Ala Eddin from the village of Al-Masa.